Willamette Valley, October 14th, after lunch session.
We had hoped tonight, and we had finished telling the impromptu survey this morning. We're probably about 70-75% done. So we're going to change the order of process just a little bit. I'm going to present my thoughts on the Lisa designs while they finish up the tally. We had hoped to do that first and then go on to the designs, but it shouldn't change too much. The goal is, all right, so this morning we sort of talked about critical information needs, and we went through the sheet and basically decided that most of the categories on that sheet are still relevant and important. Maybe the last two, maybe somewhat less so. We then had you provide your direct input in terms of what you thought were critical needs associated with those questions on a project-by-project basis, and now we're tallying those up, and hopefully we'll present those a little bit later in the afternoon after I finish up with this presentation. And we'll see how they reconcile with the POR or just our perspectives of what's happening. You got to realize that's sort of an impromptu, non-scientific survey. We didn't, you know, take a random sample, people were guarded. We weighed the different constituencies and stakeholders evenly or somehow unevenly for relevance or something. But it may give us some feeling for the studies that we consider to be more important or less important. And then after that, I plan to open up the discussion one more time and say, okay, we saw that this, from our little individual survey, this particular study question at this particular dam is important. How are we going to potentially address it? And see if we can go through one, two, or three of the high priority studies. And hopefully that will sort of inches forward into what I had hoped was today's goal. Where are we? What are we want to go? And how do we get there? So this talk right now on some release recapture methods is part of the tools that may help us get there once we decide what the high priorities are. All right. As I said, my background here on the Columbia River has been as a mark recapture theorist, working on pit tags, balloon tags, acoustic tags, radio tags, whatever tags I think are out there over the last 20-some years. And what I've gone through is basically knowing some of the critical questions that are addressed. I'm going to present some basic design issues or approaches to address those. They, in some cases, fairly generic, in some cases, fairly specific, but with an idea of sort of laying out sort of a common knowledge base that when we get to the end of the day, when we want to discuss a particular objective we want to tackle, we may have some common approaches. So the talk is going to be broken up into two segments. First, a very, very quick discussion of the constraints and considerations of doing tagging studies in the Willamette Valley. Those of you who have done so are probably painfully aware of the good, bad, and uglies of trying to work in this arena. And then the larger segment of the talk will be about critical questions and potential alternative designs for addressing them. And these are the issues I plan to address. How to estimate reef survival, assess effects of operations on dam passage, evaluate surface collector efficiency, how to estimate and determine the contribution of different life histories, fry marking studies, and a little bit about late mortality studies. So that covers a lot of interesting aspects. In terms of tagging studies, every tagging study, as far as I'm concerned, is an interdisciplinary approach. It's got to have a biologist who knows the species. You got to have a chronic person who knows the nature of the tagging and tag and the receptions, and a biometrician. And basically, the way I view it, all studies start with a sort of a top-down approach, see if my pointer, where you have study objectives that define the study. And those could be what parameter or parameters you're interested in, what hypotheses or hypotheses you're interested in testing, and sometimes the priority, because rarely can one study do multiple things really well. And then once you have the study objectives, I add the quantitative objectives. And what I mean by that, if you're going to estimate something, how precisely? What are the precision goals? Or you can test a hypothesis. What kind of statistical power do you want to be able to detect that if that effect indeed does occur? Next input would be the biological system. In this regard, to a large degree, involves how do the critters move? Do you move straight down river, like the you're in Chinook on the Columbia River, or do they go out as multiple age classes? Do they residualize? What are their behavioral movements that affect the way we design the study to estimate the parameters? Next input to this overall study design are the logistics, the constraints we have to live with, and the capabilities we have to address the study. For example, again on the Willamette, we have one major pit tag detection facility, the Willamette Falls. That has some limitations in terms of what you can and cannot do in terms of study design. And then on top of all those, once you sort of incorporate the objectives, incorporate the biology and logistics, hopefully now you have developed a tagging model to try to realistically represent those processes. And those models have assumptions. We need to be able to make sure that they're realistic and fulfilled, or at least they're robust. Again, sample sizes to make sure things are not uncomfortable and estimable. And then altogether, hopefully, if all goes well, you have a useful, defensible result with a broad breadth of inference. And it's not an easy thing. I think doing these studies is always a challenge because of all the inputs to make this proper. All right, so let's talk a little bit about constraints and considerations here in the Willamette Valley. One of the first things you have to do, throw it into biology, is the complex life histories. Chinook tend to go out over two age classes, sealant, multiple age classes, and we have to deal with that process if you're going to get survival estimates. Another issue is that the migration is often protracted over multiple months, so that the detection process can change over multiple months at a site. Then it may need to be taken into account. Also, if you're using active tags, those active tags have to have a long enough lifetime to extend beyond the migration period. And we're going to be problems here because the smaller what? The smaller the fish, typically the smaller the tag needed, the smaller the tag, the shorter the lifetime. Just as, and unfortunately, the smaller the fish, the longer the time it takes to go out. So you have these contradicting demands on your design. And then, like I said, if you're going out over multiple months, flows are changing, are going to affect changes in detection probability over time. We have to deal in here in alignment with small fish, potentially fish below the taggable size, in which case, now we have issues with highly tagged animals. I'll talk a little bit about that in more detail, but there's the issues of what type of tag. And the two major decisions are a batch tag, in other words, a tag that just says, hey, you are marked, or an individual coded tag. And it has dramatic effects on what you can and cannot estimate. And unfortunately, we want to have good information on the little guys, but they're hard to get the individual specific information that we require. So again, it's sort of push-pull kind of situations. As Russ knows, I often say, you know, if this was easy, the physicists would be doing it. Next slide, please. And then we have the limitations on detection locations with regard to pit tags. To a large degree, we have one good sound site there, the Willamette Falls, but it has a detection probability around 10%. And some say, well, you can use the NOAA troll. All right. So they have a 4-6% detection rate. And it's not how many capture, but how many you recapture. So 6% of 10% is 6% of 1%. And you're going to have very few recaptures. Even though theoretically you have multiple detection sites, you don't have enough captures to actually be able to use things that have minimal bias and good precision. One of the ironies here, or frustrations here, is unlike the Columbia River, if you benefit the detection facility at one dam, all the fish coming through that dam from all the different bases get advantage of this. Here, you put enhance the detection facility in McKenzie, it doesn't help you in this one of the other basins or sub basins. And then finally, as you observed this morning, we have a lot of questions and a lot of different objectives. And so there's lots of different studies, and again, very rarely will one study answer multiple objectives simultaneously equally well. So we might have to prioritize or do separate studies. So that's our life. That's the bubble we live in. And so now the issue is how do we do the best we can within those constraints that we have. and you've been working under those, and you know those very well. So let's go on to the next aspect, and that is sort of mating some of the critical questions with some of the alternative tagging approaches that have been or could be approached. This isn't supposed to be universal or all-encompassing, but to give some suggestions on various attacks that have and could be done. Next slide. So the first one, I thought I'd try the easy one first. This is estimating reservoir survival. A number of approaches are being conducted in the basin. Single release recapture models with active tags, paired release recapture approaches, relative recovery models, relative recovery methods with efficiency releases have been talked about or attempted. And in some cases, we're estimating reservoir survival by taking the ratio of the abundance screw trap upstream to the downstream abundance, or vice versa. And so there are lots of different approaches, and a lot of that has to do with those constraints and limitations. So let's talk about some of the alternative options here. Next slide. So this is your classic easy one. And characteristically, in here in the basin would be active tags. It's the single release recapture model, special case of the Cormac Jolly Seaver model. For some reason, my pointer isn't showing up on that screen, but you have that blue M&M up there indicating the release location, release one, and fish move downstream through those orange detection bars. So you can estimate survival from release to the first bar, capture rate at that first detection site, survival between the next two, so on and so forth. And as you probably know, in the last reach, we cannot estimate survival because if you don't see a fish, you don't know why. You don't know whether it died or whether it lived and eluded capture. So all we can estimate is the joint probability of surviving and being detected. But the key point of this is the minimum study design is what? A study with a minimum of two detection fields. Hence the crisis with having one detection site at Lower Wailata Dam. So minimum two downstream detection sites. It's easy to incorporate tag life corrections. We have a program that's a public available to do tag life survival estimates program, Atlas. These survivals are often considered to be perceived survival, and in this case, in two ways. If there's any residualization of fish, then this is the joint probability of the fish migrating and surviving. And so this is a very good model for, say, yearling Chinook that have basically two choices, to migrate or die. But for steelhead in the tributaries, they have more than two choices. They can migrate, or they can delay migration, residualize for a while, or die. So this model isn't necessarily appropriate. If you, however, apply it to such species, it's a joint probability of surviving and moving. People do use this for reach survivals, but there's one caveat, is that if there is any kind of tagging handling effects that become exhibited after the release of the fish, that gets incorporated in these reach survival estimates. So it may not be a problem if there's a 0.1% handling mortality, but if you have a 10% handling mortality, your estimate might be deflated by that much. So that's one reason why we don't necessarily apply this. Typically, this design is limited to active tags, although we do use this in pit tags systems in the Columbia River. Typically apply this to active migrants and for longer reaches. Next slide. The other classic approach to estimating reach survival is the paired release recapture model, full capture histories. Here now we have two release groups. The RT is a treatment group, RC is a control group. And what we're interested in estimating is the survival between those two release locations, that capital S next to the parentheses. We then have downstream detection sites. In the case of a full recapture model, again, you need a minimum of two downstream detection arrays. But the nice thing about this is that for each release group, we get to estimate the survivals independently for each group. In the case of this design, the survival between release locations at S, and then is the ratio of the survival for the treatment group to that of the control group in that first reach, as you see in the lower corner there. And this has been going on for decades in the Columbia River. Again, this could still include perceived survival if some of the RT fish decide to residualize. So nothing helps that whatsoever. The benefit of this approach conceptually is that if there's handling mortality, a tagging effects, the classic assumption is it's present in both groups, and when you take the ratio, it cancels.
Right.
Unfortunately, that's more of a urban myth than a reality. Tagging effects are the kind of gift that keeps on giving. The longer the fish are in the river, the more they typically are expressed. And so that it never really quite adjusts by this ratio, but it's better than not adjusting at all. Next slide. Here's a sort of an approach that's been going on. It's the peri-release relative recovery. Classic example is two slope releases with a single downstream detection site at Willamette Falls Dam. Very classical. The objective of the study is to estimate survival between the control, treatment, and release groups at capital S up there. The model assumes that the survival of both groups below the control group, that SC, is the same for both groups, and the capture probabilities are the same for both groups, so that we can use just the relative recovery fractions, the fraction of treatment fish recovered divided by the fraction of control fish recovered is our estimate of survival, under the assumptions that the control survival and the capture probability is constant for both groups. Typically, this type of study is used when the downstream recovery is fairly close to the release location, so that there is not a lot of opportunity for lack of mixing going on. You typically do try to stagger the releases so that the control fish are being released at the time the treatment fish are arriving, so that there is downstream mixing, so that there is some plausibility that both groups are sharing the same SC survival and capture probability. One way that they can occur is by looking for downstream mixing, and classic thing is to look at mixing plots. And some of the reports I've seen, you'll have the cumulative count, arrival count, and the vertical axis plot against time. A better plot would be the cumulative percent arrival against time. And if those two curves are synonymous, you have downstream mixing. And then you might have the plausibility that both groups have common survival and capture probabilities. That can be easily tested with a chi-square test or what's called a Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, sometimes called the vodka test. next slide. You can drink, Jen. Okay. this is a variation on that design, still the same control treatments, but now rather than assuming the capture probabilities are the same for both groups across time, especially if they're not mixed, is to do some sort of efficiency releases. So here you see that RC is in the dot-dot are a series of efficiency releases released over time. Basically, we still assume that the survival downstream for both groups is the same, but now we can, if there's lack of mixing, we can get group-specific recovery rates at that one detector site. The probability of recovery, collection efficiency would be simply the number detected over the release size as seen down there. This application, potentially for longer reaches where you don't expect good downstream mixing, because now we have the potential of adjusting for unequal detection probabilities.
Next slide. What's RE, John?
I'm sorry.
What is RE?
That is a release group for the efficiency group. So basically what you do, you release some fish very close to the dam, you assume that none of those fish die, so what you see in terms of capture rate is purely the detection efficiency.
Okay.
Sorry, that's a good question. I didn't address it nearly as well as I should have. So basically now, over time, with these efficiency releases, we have independent estimates of P, and we can use those to adjust for detection probabilities over time if it's differential between the two groups. The next slide, I promise is about the only equation in there. Basically, what you're doing is taking the, say, if you have a three-month passage at Willamette Falls Dam, you might say, break it up into weekly groups. Each week you have an efficiency release to estimate the efficiency during that week. That would be those PIs. You adjust the actual observed counts by those weekly detection efficiencies, and those actually end up being abundance estimates of the fish arrived that week. And so now you have adjusted estimates. There's basically two philosophies or approaches to doing these types of studies. One I call a design-based, the other one model-based. The design-based says, okay, I'm going to stratify the study, say, by weeks, and each week I'm going to do an efficiency release to estimate the efficiency for that week, per se. And over the course of time, if it's 2 months, I'm going to have 8 releases to adjust for those 8 releases, period. The other approach is, okay, I'm going to do releases over time and try to model that efficiency release as a function of environmental flow barriers and dam operations, so that not only can I use that model for the P's I need for this year's study, but potentially beyond. The difference is that the design base makes minimal assumptions. We don't have to assume the efficiency model is correct. We just have to assume that the efficiency releases are representative. The problem is, with the design base, you're never allowed to stop doing efficiency releases. Next year, if you do a study, you've got to do efficiency releases again. Next year, over and over again. On the other hand, the model base says, okay, if we've done 72 efficiency releases, we have a model that releases efficiency to dam operations and flow, we can use this infinitum if we assume that it holds and is invariant over time. You never know. All right, those are the two approaches, but this potentially corrects for differences in arrival time that may result in differences in detection probability due to the fact that the flows might be different. The only problem is, while it corrects for differences in detection probability between the release groups, it doesn't adjust for potential differences in that control survival. So it corrects for one of potentially two ailments, but it's better than none. All righty, next slide, please. All right, so next little topic, effects of different operations on dam passage. I'm going to break this up into a couple components. First, a little bit just on experimental design, and then some tagging options.
Yes, question.
Next slide. Based on my experience in the Columbia River, when we're interested in looking at the effects of different dam operations on downstream passage survival, we'll use a randomized block or systematic block design. Basically, we'll compare two treatments because the philosophy is to do one thing well rather than a lot of things poorly. And you don't have enough replicates typically to do a lot of different treatment conditions, so we'll compare two different spill operations, or two dam operations, but not 72. And you just don't have enough replication there. So typically it's two alternative test conditions. Those test conditions are typically run for 2 day consecutive days. As you see in the bottoms right there, those are 8 days. The first 4 days would be one block where we randomize such that the control happened in the first part. In the second block, days 5 through 8, the randomization happened that the control was in the second part of the block. You can do this across the season. So 2 day treatments, there's typically a 2 hour, what do you want to call it, differentiation between the switching of the treatments so that the 4 bait tail race conditions equilibrate between transitions so we don't count the fish during those equilibrations. And typically we run these experiments during the middle 90% of the runs. That's sort of general procedures for both the Mid-Columbia and federal dams. Now, that's what you're doing in terms of experimentation. What are you doing in terms of estimation? So go to the next slide if you would. Now here's a couple options that have been done varying degrees. The two options I'm going to illustrate, sir, depend on how much information you want. More information, more releases, more costs, so on and so forth. So this is basically a single release model. This is how it sort of works. You release fish sufficiently above the dam so they arrive at the dam as run-of-river fish would do. In other words, they're spatially nominally distributed. They have enough time to do that, so they go through the passage routes as run-of-river fish are. And in this little graph, I have two routes, a powerhouse and a spill. In front of the dam, there is a dense acoustic array that identifies those fish, those R1 fish that have arrived successfully at the face of the dam. And then furthermore, it identifies which of those fish went through the various routes. So it identifies that of those R1, some NPH fish arrived successfully and went through the powerhouse. Some other NSP fish arrived at that and went through the spillway. And of those, down at the downstream detector, little NPH and little SPH fish were detected. So it's a relative recovery method. And so from this particular approach, there's a couple things you can get. You can get the passage proportions. And typically when you do passage proportions, that dam face array is so dense that there's 100% detection across the whole face of the dam. But I never believe in assumptions. So I will do a double array that allows me to test that assumption and adjust if they aren't the same. But we'll start with the hope that it will be the same to simplify interpretation and analysis. So that first you'll get passage proportions so that in an experiment you can see how the treatments affect passage proportions. Next thing you can get is with the relative recoveries, you cannot estimate survival, but what you can do is estimate relative survival. And what they'll do is they'll pick usually the most benign route, in this case would be the spill, and reference relative survival of the powerhouse to the spill. So for example, that calculation, if you have a value of say 0.98, it would suggest the fish going through the powerhouse are living 98% as well as the spillway fish. And then you say, okay, that's not so bad. You don't know exactly what it is, but you know it's pretty hard. On the other hand, if it's 75%, you know it's not very good. So yeah, at least you have a feeling in the wind in terms of up, down, or sideways of how things are going. Okay, and you can do that under the two treatment conditions. And the advantage of this is that it's a single release, not very complicated, not very expensive. We can up the ante. We can go to the next slide. And this is type of design is done a fair amount in the mid-Columbias. They want to know not only passive proportions that we have from the other design, but they also want to know actual route-specific survivals. So you have the same upstream release that R0 is feeding fish into the face of the dam. We're identifying which of those fish go into the two different routes, in this example, the powerhouse or spillway, and we get the relative recoveries as we did in the last group. But we do one thing, additional thing. We actually do a paired release in one of the routes. And the one I'm illustrating here is the powerhouse. So now we have a peer release, so we can get actual powerhouse passage survival for that group. So now what we do is we ratchet the information. So from the relative recoveries of those NPHs and those SPHs, we get the relative survival of the spillway to the powerhouse. From the peer release, we get the absolute survival through the powerhouse. And then by taking the powerhouse survival by the relative survival, we get the survival through the spillway. So we didn't have to do two paired releases, one for each route. We did a paired release in one of the routes and got relative survivals for the other routes. This is not a big deal when you have two routes, but when you have two powerhouses, a spillway, a sluiceway, and stuff, it makes a big difference. It's much, much more efficient. And so now we have the passage proportions that are going through the various routes. We have the absolute survivals through the spillway and the powerhouse. The powerhouse calculated directly from the paired release, the spillway survival through the ratcheting. But now you can put the pieces together. You can take the bottom line, the overall dam survival is the survival going through the powerhouse times proportion going through the powerhouse, plus the survival through the spillway times proportion going through the spillway, and that's the dam passage survival. So now you've got your cake and eat it too. You're getting the proportions of fish going through the routes, the route specific survivals, and how they put the pieces together. Yes.
At some of these projects, there's another passage route. Besides the powerhouse and the spillway, there's a regulating outlet. There's a third alternative. Can you add that to this?
Yes. All you would do is, again, see how many of those R0 fish went through that route and how many got downstream. So you wouldn't have to do another paired release. You're just figuring out how many went through that third route or fourth route. And that's what we do. You know, like I said, in a lot of the dams, we have a spillway, powerhouse, a sluiceway, maybe a bypass system.
Right.
So there's multiple routes, but you don't have to do paired releases in each route to get route-specific survivals. And that's a very important cost savings. And so you would do this under both controlled treatment conditions. Now you can ask lots of questions. Do the treatments affect passage proportions? Do the treatments affect the survival through a particular route? Does the treatment affect overall dam survival?
Yeah, question.
Well, I was going to say the survival rates through a particular route tend to be have high variability, I would say, associated with the estimate if the number of fish going through the route is
small. If it's a rare route, then you're getting a small sample size. Yeah. Exactly. In which case, you either have to live with it or ratchet up your numbers, I know.
And I would think that control release would be real important, too.
The control, exactly. I mean, it has to be good control, you know, absolutely. Some studies, depending on the construct of the dam, they will have a control for, like, the paired release at the powerhouse. That's, you know, just above and below the powerhouse. But then the powerhouse, per se, is not necessarily the tail race of the powerhouse isn't representative of the dam, per se, right? So it may have a separate control for the dam itself. It just depends on the geography and geometry of the dam and operations. But this has been working quite nicely at a number of places. So these are two different approaches where you can start asking the question, how do dam operations affect passage? Yes, ma'am.
What's the maximum duration of active tags these days?
Depends on the ping, right? For all politicians, it depends. But no, it depends on the size of the tag. But you can basically assume a month is probably good in general for most of the survival studies. Next slide.
And John, that depends. You know, some of the main stem, Columbia Snake River, the fish go by pretty quick, so you want them to, I'm just following up on it, you want them to close pretty quick so you have a good chance of detecting them, but some of the projects, the Willamette Valley project, passage is a very slow process. So some of those, we use tags that only pulse about every 10 seconds and they last like 5 months. Because the fish overwinter, you know. So it's the politician answer, right?
It's also, again, that marriage of the biology and electronics in the study goals.
Right.
All right. This is another option out there. This is one that's being used quite widely in the Columbia River as part of the 2008 BIOP survival compliance study. It's called the virtual paired release model. Again, it starts off with a very dense four-bay array. We release fish, again, upriver, that R1, that feeds fish to the face of the dam. We release them far enough above the dam so they arrive as nominal fish would and go through the routes as nominal fish would. And we identify those fish and we form what's called a virtual release. And that virtual release is then used to estimate survival from the face of the dam to an array sufficiently far downriver that there's very little chance that a fish that died during dam passage would still have an active tag that could be detected. So that first array is 30, 40 kilometers. But the goal of the study is to estimate dam passage survival face the dam to the tail race. So we've now got an estimate through that section, but another 20 kilometers to boot. So what happens then is to adjust for that extra mortality, we do a paired release in the tail race and at that first downstream detection array. So now we estimate dam passage survival as a ratio of that virtual release, which estimates survival from dam face to the first array, divided by the paired release, which estimates survival from the tail race to that array, to get our survival estimate. And this will give you dam passage survival, and it's more efficient than the other approach. The other approach, you build up the dam estimate by putting all the little pieces together, but all the little pieces have noise, and noise only adds to noise, so it's less precise than doing it this way. But on the other hand, if that four-bay array is dense enough, you can also figure out what routes they went through, and you get all the same information you got in the other models as well. So we use this, because this will give us more precise estimates of dam passage survival, and we lose nothing about also getting route-specific information from the dams as well. All right, next slide. All right, so next topic. Optimal locations and operations of collectors, just part of the gospel. You know, we've done this for a long time, you have done this. You know, in terms of locating a collector, you need to know where the fish are, maybe use hydroacoustics, fish movements, 2D and 3D acoustic arrays. It needs to be recognized that in 3D arrays, the vertical accuracy is much worse than the horizontal accuracy, despite some statements to the fact. In terms of fish collection efficiency, people have used acoustic tags, pit tags, acoustic and pit tags, and I'll illustrate an example of that in a moment. And then for survival, I've seen everything from like balloon tags to estimate acute mortality, to acoustic or pit tags to estimate both acute and sort of delayed or chronic mortality going on. What I'd like to illustrate in the next slide is a what's going on at Cushman Den. A couple of people, or reports, and people have mentioned the Cushman study as sort of a prototype for something that, for studies that could happen around here. And it's an interesting sort of tagging approach. Again, I apologize for my artistic depiction of something that's much more glamorous. All the floating surface collectors, that green football oval. And what the objective is to estimate fish collection efficiency from the zone of inference, or the ZOI, through to the juvenile sorting facility. So it's the joint probability of being entered into the collector and surviving through the collection process. And the process involves a dual release. Some fish that are dual tagged, acoustic and pit tagged, other fish that are simply pit tagged. The study can be done completely with the acoustic pit tag fish, because how it's designed is that the zone of inference is an acoustic array, so we use that to identify the fish that cross the beginning line. And then inside the throat of the collector, we have an acoustic array. And then those dual pit tag fish are then detected at the pit tag detector at the juvenile sorting facility. And with that information, we can determine the proportion of the release that gets to the line, and of those that get to the line, which proportion survives and gets into the collector, and what proportion of that survives through the collector. And so our, in this case, the fish collection efficiency is the theta times the lambda, and you could stop right there. But what we do is also, simultaneously with releasing the acoustic tag fish, we also release pit tag fish. The pit tag fish are detected at the same location as the acoustic tag fish in the throat of the detector and also in the juvenile facility. But what you cannot do is differentiate how many cross the line versus how many get into the system. But nevertheless, you get boosted precision. Acoustic tag costs about $200, pit tag about $100. So for the cost of adding one acoustic tag, you can put 200 pit tag fish out there, and increases the precision of the study much, much faster. And so it's an interesting adaptation of using acoustic tags, which would directly estimate the process, along with being cost effective by milking some of the information but with a cheaper tag. So, and like I said, that's sort of the approach that's being used, at Cushman. I just finished the analysis last week. Alrighty. Next topic. Okay. Contribution of different life histories. We talked about that and debated that a little bit this morning. I wanted to talk about some of the approaches that are being done to evaluate that. In the Columbia River, there's the goal or objective of estimating brood year survival of smolts. So the purpose here is to estimate the cohort survival of a particular brood and also determine the age class strength. Despite the fact that, for example, fall chinook may migrate up over 2 years or steelhead might migrate up over 6 years, what they want to know is from the natal stream to some downstream detection facility, the Columbia River is usually a dam, what's the overall survival of that cohort, that brood year, regardless of how long it takes to get to that downstream site. And so what we use is what's called multi-state release recapture models, fancy name for the fact that unlike the other models we just showed, we assume all the fish do the same thing. Here in multi-state, obviously if the survival of a sub-year-old out-migrating is going to be different than a fish that decides to residualize for year out-migrating in year one. So they're different. So why assume they're the same? So we develop models that don't assume that. So in using these multi-state models, what we do is we start with mark and release of H-class zero fish, sub-yearlings, and then we continue to mark and release known age fish of older ages over time that are members of that same cohort. And the way we do that is when a person collects a fish, older fish, they not only pit tag it, but they'll pull a scale,
to do scale reading, determine the age, and determine back the year, the root year. And we'll talk about more about that in a moment. We have multiple downstream locations, and the model allows for residualization, movement, and survival in any way, shape, or form. But I'll show you the next slide. All right, okay, this is scary. We'll take it bit by bit. So here's, this was a model that was used for steelhead. The study started with tagging subs in 2008, and that's that R1 up there in the corner. How does this marker doesn't work? So here in 2008, some sub-zeros were marked upstream, and then those vertical lines, as you see, go down, are different downstream detection arrays. They could be detection arrays in the tributary or the main stem. And so one option is for those fish to go completely horizontally. In other words, during as a sub-yearling, they migrate out as sub-yearlings. They go through reach after reach after reach after reach. Another option, though, is for those sub-yearlings to go down diagonally. In other words, they residualize in that first reach for a year. So now they're one-year-olds, and then possibly out-migrate the rest of the way as one-year-olds. Another option is for those sub-yearlings to residualize in that first reach for 2 years, and then as two-year-olds in 2010, out-migrate the rest of the way. And all the other diagonals you see, there are other, all the other ways that could happen. You residualize for one place, and then move for one reach, and then you residualize again in another one. So it's all sort of ways that these fish can hopscotch, if that's the right technical term, fish hopscotch, their way out the stream. And the goal is to estimate overall the survival of that cohort to some downstream detection location. But what happens in reality is that these tagging studies happen year after year after year. So now in 2009, people are out there with a screw trap or whatever collecting subs. But while they're collecting subs, they're collecting older fish. So they tag the older fish, pull a tag, and pull some scales, and then say, ah, these are one-year-olds. They must have been from the 2008 cohort. They're tagged and released. And now you see the second set of bars are here. The ones could go out downriver as ones, or they could residualize the two-year-olds and then go out. And then in 2010, they're again collecting subs as part of their market studies, but they catch some older fish. They capture, tag, pull a scale, and realize, ah, these fish are two-year-olds. They also belong to the 2008 cohort. And they're released, and then they migrate out. And so you have this sort of multi-state, multi-release process, and that's what's going on year after year in a lot of the basins in the Columbia Basin with all the pit tag arrays that have proliferated in the tributaries. And the goal, again, is to estimate survival from that first location to some downstream location. What you get initially from these models is just terrible. You get the joint probability of doing something and surviving, which means almost nothing. In other words, the fish decide to move and survive or decide not to move and decide, and it's sort of meaningless, but you can put those meaningless parameters back together to get overall survival and a few other pieces of information. Next slide. So we have a program called TripPIT, which stands for Tributary Pit Tag Analysis. It's free on the web. As part of our BPA development, it allows for multiple years of age classes from 2 years for sub, for say, bull chinook till 6-7 years for steelhead. Multiple downstream detection locations, both in the tributaries and main streams. It allows residualization to occur or not occur in any route you want. It's very adaptive where the behavior is. And it allows for single release locations, as I showed, or multiple downstream locations. Next slide. And so what you get are results specific to a particular cohort for a particular brood year. You get those transition probabilities that are limited information, but then they're all presented graphically in output. But you also get overall cohort survival to downstream locations. You also get the conditional survival of individual classes of that cohort, and you get cohort strengths. So for example, you release some fish up in the Naha and you detect it at a downstream dam over 5 years. You're all going to get the overall survival of that brood year to that dam, and also what proportion of those fish are of the various age classes. And you can do that upstream as well. And the idea behind that, in terms of overall assessment, is to couple that then with maybe fry survivals to get to the point where you can tag them, and couple that with in-stream survivals and adult returns to get life cycle information.
tagging for these?
I'm sorry?
How many fish are they tagging for this?
Not enough. I mean, you know, we've had one in terms of the subs, 500. You prefer 1,000. But it's not tens of thousands. It's surprising.
But and so and that's just to get juvenile survival. I mean,
not that juvenile survival is real high. We're finding it to be quite pretty dismal. But it's my recommendation. We did a sample size for one of the mid-Columbia PUDs is doing a study like this and implementing. We suggested 1,200 zeros each year.
But they have to be big enough to pit tag.
And you pit tag them. And then also in subsequent years, when you're getting those 1,000 subs in subsequent years, any adults, I mean older fish you pick, you can tag as well. And that supplements the sample size.
Right.
Because you can imagine if you just did zeros, it was a steelhead going out up to 6 years, the number of those zeros that were six, all we wanted was going to be very small. But in the sixth year, you might pick up more sixes. And it tracks your out migration, so that helps with the precision as you go along. So it's sort of like a round robin. Each year is added to the previous information as you go through the sample size study. And that's what's happening in most of these studies. The smoke monitoring is not happening once, but it's happening year after year after year, and it's sort of compounding upon itself. And what was happening was that no one was really knowing how to analyze this. We also found that when they started doing this, when they collected the older fish, they weren't pulling a scale, so they couldn't assign it to the brood year. So all the tagging information was of limited value.
Size-based or something like that.
Yeah. But, I mean, they weren't even getting to that point. I'm not going to go into philosophies or psychologies. But one of the first things was, part of the tagging is paying for scale reading. This is parse and parcel. It's not tag costs, it's tag and reading costs. Because otherwise you don't have any value in those older fish tags.
Do you have a write-up on a trip pit somewhere?
Yeah, I've got a paper just came out. I can give that to you. Also on the DART website, there is the program and the user manual.
Okay.
And email me, we can get you some more. All right, next. All right, a little bit about fry market studies, because these were fish that were pit taggable, right? And beyond, but what happens between, button up and that point? I once tried to write a paper on fry market studies, and the editors came back and said they didn't know what a fry was. I had to write the paper as tiny fish market studies.
They've never heard of small fry?
Yes. So, I don't know. It always makes me think of Don Ho, tiny bubbles in the sea or something like that. But anyhow, small fish studies. There's a number of considerations in doing this, and again, I have a manuscript that I'm willing to give to anyone. But basically, in marking these smaller fish, there's several considerations. One of the first considerations is the nature of the tag, whether it's a batch mark or individual code. Has a huge effect on what you can or cannot do. The second thing is when you recapture the fish, do you have to kill or not kill the fish to read the tag? In some tags, you have to destroy the fish to read the fact that it was tagged. That limits the number of recaptures, obviously. and another possibility is whether that the fish are capable of having multiple marks. So, those three considerations also go into the design of the study and what you can and cannot estimate. Just a couple of real simple slides just to sort of emphasize the point. Here's a case of a single release of batch marked fish. So say 1,000 fish all marked identically, and they have downstream detection sites at those zero locations. And if you catch your fish, you examine it, but you examine it, you kill it, so it doesn't go back in the water. In that type of study design, you have fish fry, you do not have an estimate. You can estimate nothing from that study. On the other hand, you go down to the next line, single release of batch marks, and you capture them at the same location, examine the fish, and re-release them. Again, nothing's estimable.
unless you have the possibility of somehow doing some form of mark recapture, nothing is estimable with these batch marks in these individual, unless they're individually coded. Next line. So here's one possible option. Trying to get away with it. So here you have a single release of R1 fish. You have two downstream detection sites. At the first downstream detection site, those fish that are caught are examined. If they are marked, they are given a second mark and re-released. And then they're released downriver, and the fish could be either destructively or non-destructively resampled. In this case, you could estimate survival between the R1 and R2 release locations, but nothing else. At least you can estimate survival here. Okay, the key thing is you have to mark, remark the fish. Another example, more classic example, on the next slide, is a pair of blues. You got a batch mark of R1 fish, a different batch mark for the R2 fish. You're interested in estimating survival between those two release locations. And now it doesn't matter whether those downstream locations are destructive or non-destructive. You can estimate survival between those release locations. As long as you have two different distinct marks. I was involved in a study not too long ago that did something like this, but we made one fatal error. We used visual implanted Lascar tags of different colors. And we captured a person we didn't realize was colorblind. Oh, 50 years old and didn't know he was colorblind.
Can you use red and green tags?
I wanted a kneecap, but I'm not allowed to.
The bomb, right?
Yeah. Anyhow, but point being here, with the small fish, you have limited ways of tagging them, and that really constrains how you can and what you can estimate. And you do need to consider those three things: batch or individual ID, destructive, non-destructive sampling, whether you mark and remark. And those are the options. And again, I have a publication handout where you can ask for that sort of summarizes all of this.
I can see a lot of problems with trying to adapt this to study survival of fish, say, in a given reach of a reservoir, because you've got the complications of rearing and growing, plus, we know from lots of studies, if you drop them off too close to the forebay, their behavior tends to be fried and they don't act normally. Mm-hmm. You could probably use that for like exit areas below projects.
Now, is this considered your staggered entry zoning? What you're talking about?
Yeah.
Can you could you use, instead of detection locations, just detection times, and do it within the reservoir?
Yes, yes. Time or space could be switched, but not both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, but you still have to remark any fish you captured?
Yeah, if you use a batch.
Okay.
Yes. If you have a single, you were a marked fish kind of ID, you'd have to have a second mark that says you were rehandled in some way.
But even if it's destructive sampling?
If you destruct the sampling, then you're SOL.
Yeah, you're SOL.
You're fried already.
No pun intended.
This is just if you had individual marks to begin with, you
don't need to remark. Yeah, if you had individual marks, you have much more flexibility because now you have the possibility of recapture. But even then, if you had individual marks and all your sampling was destructive, you had no potential recaptures, and you're very limited. So all tags, they basically assume that we have to somehow estimate capture probabilities. And one way we do that is that you have a release location and two downstream detection sites. So now you have two types of fish that go through here. You have fish that we're seeing here and here, upstream and downstream, so we know they survived this transit. And then some were detected, some were, that's how we have to capture probability. But unless you have two downstream detections and you know who was marked and not marked, you can't pull out the capture probability. If you can't pull out the capture probability, you can't sort out the survival probability. I can explain more. I'm going fast, I apologize.
Okay,
again, the whole point being is there's lots of interest and a critical need to understand small fish survival, but the limitations of marking make it more difficult to study, and we have to be a little bit more clever with the techniques.
Well, so would this be something you could use to look at reservoir mortality with fish that you can't put spit tags in, so you have to batch mark them somehow. I don't know how. I mean, I don't know.
Like
you
like
get to
wire tag number maybe something like that. That's possible. Really small, then thin clip the second one.
Oh, yeah, that's possible. Or you know, Vesper tag the eye and thin clip the second time, you know, or something like that.
I just don't know, where would you recover them twice if you're trying to, you know.
If you had a
similar facility, the head of the resin will trap.
Well,
maybe I'm jumping. Am I jumping ahead of your presentation? I'm just trying to figure out how this fits in with our question. So stop.
Well, if you've got small fish that you think are rearing in an area for a long time, you would keep, instead of, I guess you do it by time instead of by location. Mm-hmm. You just resample the same place and give an estimate that, you know, this many fish died over a 30-day period or whatever it was. Right.
But yeah, because it could be one fixed body that you're sampling over time.
Right.
And now the locations become the time periods, mm-hmm. but you still need to capture, mark,
right.
and recapture
right.
somehow. So yeah. that you have a capture history of right. sorts.
Yeah. Then it becomes an issue of sampling effort to get an adequate number of recaptures in places like this
yeah.
to be able to estimate forever.
And then when you recapture them, they hopefully are big enough that then you could put a pit tag in or something. So that's this kind of
your second mark.
When you get a second mark. In
the as it grew up.
You know, there's pit tags that are a lot smaller than 12 millimeters.
Mm-hmm.
8 millimeters, 9 millimeters. People don't use those very often, but they're... I've mentioned that for the last couple of years, but no one seems to listen.
So, I don't know. I mean, I guess you could do it. I'm just trying to think where you'd get enough fish.
Right.
If you were doing intense screw trapping at the head of the reservoir, you could get enough fish that you did some kind of, with this initial dye type thing. But how long does that last on fish?
Not very long.
Not very long.
Like 2 weeks.
And then if you had French people out there doing all kinds of netting, and then your shore and the gill netting, well, the gill netting, you're going to kill them, but doing a whole bunch of netting, you might recover some of the ones you've marked, and then you might tag and keep doing it.
Fish and Wildlife Service recaptures Snake River Falls, Chinook, along the banks all the time. They have the same fish. I don't know, remember off the top of my head what the proportions are, but they do sample them along the banks up there.
Well, some of the early work that's been involved with quite a bit, we see them coming in with the screw trap, you see them in the near shore. But then we haven't had any efficient way of recapturing them once they move offshore. Mm-hmm. There's been
that
some
being destructive.
And you don't catch many in the downstream.
Yeah, gill netting is
trap.
One way to go.
That'd be another if you could get them down below. Downstream.
One way to get around it, I mean, that'd be perfect, but is not use the natural origin fish.
Right.
Just simulate it with release of hatchery fry to mimic what the wild fry are doing.
Right.
Another batch of release another group of hatchery fish. Same cohort later on in the reservoir as your R2.
Yeah.
Would you have to track and release them at a similar size that you expect the first group is now at?
Yeah.
Have they grown?
Yeah, that would be.
Can you see
and I think Fred, the capture rates get real low too when the reservoirs warm up in the mid to late summer, kind of hard to get recaptures?
Or it's the live recapture to be able to remark them or some sort of stuff.
Well, yeah, I guess that would be the point.
We can. Yeah, I can.
You can catch and kill them.
Yeah.
I can catch the numbers.
Yeah. Well, a physicist can do that.
Reanimation.
Fred's not starting.
Well, let's finish up with a couple more slides because we got some more interesting things to do. The last topic, just a couple slides, a few conversations, people have mentioned interest in delayed mortality, and so just the very simple approaches to beginning to look at this, one of the minimum design requirements I thought I'd consider. Next slide. So here's a very simple way of estimating delayed mortality. The way I define delayed mortality is mortality that occurred beyond the immediate zone of the effect. So So we might be estimating the immediate zone, the acute mortality, but then there's a lingering effect beyond that zone, and this is what we're interested in. So at the very minimum, if you don't have any attempt to estimate some sort of delayed mortality, you need two release groups and a minimum of two detection fields. Anything less than that is a dream or a nightmare. So let's take the very simplest approach. You have a treatment release, an RT, a control release, RC. You're interested in initial survival between those two locations, and we do the paired release relative recovery method to the first detection rate, as we talked about earlier. So you can use the relative recovery method to get an estimate of that acute survival, if you will. But then you can continue those fish down to, say, the next array, to the of which you see NT2, NC2, and you can, once again, calculate the relative recovery of those two groups and estimate survival. If there's no delayed mortality, then you'd expect survival in that second region to be the same for the two groups, and the two estimates, S hat and S hat prime, to be the same. And so the ratio would be 1, and 1 minus 1 is 0 delayed mortality. On the other hand, if it's lower in the second group, you're going to pick it up. So this is an example, and you're already doing this of sorts, using the Willamette Falls Dam. You're using the first array as the detection of the juveniles, as they all migrate to the dam, and then you're waiting for the second detection as the adults coming back. So in some ways, that's the design you're using to, and you can estimate delayed mortality as you separate between up at, you know, to the falls, back to the falls.
Well, it could be ocean mortality.
I'm sorry?
It could be ocean mortality.
Yeah, but you're
and not related to the dam passage.
You're assuming they're both getting the same.
Delayed, yes.
Yeah.
It could be, the delayed mortality may be happening in the ocean, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. This is the simplest design. Anything short of this, you can't do anything. This is the minimum building blocks. The next slide is more of the classic example. Here's your classic paired release approach, where you have full capture histories. Each place you know whether the fish was detected or not, and it's re-released or re-examined. And so again, in the first reach, you can estimate survival at S1. And each subsequent reach, you can estimate the survival using that paired release. And they're all basically trying to estimate the relative survival between the control and treatments. If there's no delayed mortality, again, you would expect the S hat and S hat prime to be the same. Also, you'd expect if there's no delayed mortality, the S12 in the second region to be the same as S22 in the second region. So you can do hypothesis testing. If it's significant, you can estimate delayed mortality in the second region as that. And you have analogous estimates. So you might have different levels of delayed mortality in different reaches as you go down. And this is your full capture history model. So this is your, I'm not saying this is your Cadillac version, but it's the desirable version. The earlier one is sort of your minimum bare bones approach. But again, you need at least two release groups and two downstream detection facilities to be able to start doing this. And so, again, you can't do it in terms of right now survival to Willamette Falls and then see if there's chronic effects, delayed effects back through the adult process.
But
you can't say, you know, right now, you know, through the project and then say to Granite or Willamette Falls.
What about
that?
But what about the active tag studies? You could do that.
If you could do the active tags, yes. Then you can put multiple arrays down and you could potentially do it as you see fit. Exactly.
We did that at Cougar in that winter.
2012.
Well, in Detroit, didn't we? Yeah, but we estimated the delayed mortality. The fish went downstream when we did the
work. We went down to the mouth.
In Cougar. We went well down into the Willamette,
right.
But
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
These are just basic designs. Mm-hmm. We haven't sort of married up necessarily what you actually have in terms of capabilities or not. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of interesting, you know, having worked on Cougar, so much has been invested in tagging infrastructure. You know, over the last 20 years. You're sort of early in that process here. You know, but maybe, I hate to speak out of turn, but maybe part of the investment is to develop that infrastructure so you can do more.
We've been trying to get the Willamette Falls pit detector approved, and it's been very difficult because it's operated by PGE. The dam is owned there.
Yeah. It's still a one.
What?
Yeah.
It's still just one.
So yeah. Basically, this was sort of a primer on general approaches and general designs to attack. That certainly isn't fully encompassing, but something to sort of food for thought. What we want to do now, which is what we wanted to do right after lunch, is to give a drum roll and present the results of our survey.
Well, why don't we take our break now, and then we might be able
to... Oh, cliffhanger.
Yeah, no, just because it was put out more than we could do.
Are we still tallying?
Yeah. Mortality for reservoir.
The survey doesn't
say much. Yeah, I try to talk slowly for you.
Oh yeah, I was wondering like how many more scans have been about
Saturday,
down on
I'm going to And then we were going, why is the
And actually, I'm not going to be able to do this.
We'll fix it up.
Hope you had a good one.
I didn't remark.
I lost my business.
Where's the card key?
Oh, it's in the room.
There might be one on the other end. There were three of them in the room. She's on her way out right now.
It's just a breaking point right now. Jim,
pretty close.
So the first thing we want to do after the break here is to go over the survey that we took this morning. Again, admittedly, this is not a scientific survey. It's based on who is willing and who is willing to vote and who is willing to participate. I believe there's 24 people here. 18 people participated. No, I did not intentionally because I'm the facilitator. There are a few other people who also didn't. In this graph, again, the various rows are the various categories we talked about first thing in the morning. I wish we agreed that most all of them were important. Perhaps the last two are not so terribly important, if you recall. And then each set of columns is based on a different project. The Troy, Foster, Cougar, Lookout Point, so on and so forth. But under each dam, there's three columns, and I'd like to explain those to you. The rightmost column, say, for example, under Detroit, the NA of 11%. What that is that 11% of the respondents decided or chose not to vote.
They put a question mark.
They put a question mark, and for any reason, they decided not to vote. Then, of the remaining people who did vote, 50% thought it was critical. 50% thought it was not critical. So basically, the two columns are for conditional that a person chose to vote. Does that make sense? So the three columns do not add up to 100%. The first two columns do.
Oh, I see.
Yes, exactly. And so, as you see, from a couple people to sometimes as many as 25%. 50% of people chose not to vote on a particular category because they didn't want to. They were knowledgeable or whatever. The other thing that you should note here, we try to sort of color code them. The redder the cell, the higher the percentage. The sort of pastel to white is around 50%. And then the greener, the smaller. So gradates from solid red to white to solid green. So the idea was that you could sort of take a visual look to see where the hot spots are sort of located. So, for example, under Detroit, the 4-bay abundance and the hydraulic setting on fish performance were given high scores by people in this audience. On the other hand, reloading at Detroit was considered to be highly unimportant at 73%.
So, when I look at this and when I was looking at the numbers being entered, the most tallies any one box got was 12 out of 18.
12 to 50, somewhere in that neighborhood, because again, 18 was the max.
Right, so 12 was the maximum that anybody agreed on. There was no 13s through 18. And then that critical and not critical are often not very red or not very green. It just, that kind of highlights the whole process for me, is like, we don't agree on what needs to be done. And so
I'm not quite sure whether the fact that people, a fair block of people just chose that they didn't vote means uncertainty. I mean, they don't.
I'm not even looking at the not applicable. I'm looking at, quite often, the critical versus not critical is 50-50.
Or 40-60.
Or 40-60. I think the bigger problem is for us to figure out what we can agree needs to happen to figure out what happens with fish passage facility and then get someone like yourself to tell us the best way to get that information. But it's more in terms of us as a group collectively deciding what the objectives are, or, you know, the Corps saying, well, we think this is a critical objective we can't move forward without, and we're going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
So what happened? It, quite often.
I think part of it also, though, was in trying to simplify, you know, detailed study concepts into, you know, something simple like this. So, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that we have so much supposed disagreement. I think we do have real disagreement, but I guess I'd like to, instead of try to figure out, and I know Ann wasn't proposing this, I think I'm agreeing with what Ann is proposing, which is let's talk about kind of where you, your presentation and how we can apply those kinds of concepts to do the studies that, you know, there are some high priorities mm-hmm. of all the different kinds of studies. There just may not be high in all the different reservoirs. I mean, one may be you want reservoir survival in one reservoir, and another one you might want, I don't know what it is, you know, reach survival or passage success with operations.
Yeah, the hope was that we identify a few important ones, and then we can start say, okay, given that this is considered to be important, how do we go about studying it? You know, are we going about it now? How are we going about it now, and will we change things, or is that the right approach to doing so? Before we do though, I'm just looking at the real red ones. There's some real red criticals, but there's a few really red non-criticals. There's some beliefs that. And people have that certain things really aren't important as well. For example, I'm looking at, what is it, debris loading on facilities and fish at Foster. 90% of people said that voted and said it wasn't critical. Is that a surprise? Or does that make sense?
I think, for me, I was voting on it's not critical to design a study to analyze debris loading. If debris loading is a problem, then we'll figure out a way to get the debris out of the reservoir. Is what I mean, you know, what are you going to do? Just say, oh, gee, we got a lot of debris now. I mean, so that's why I voted as a, you know, not critical for the purpose of this group.
Sorry,
John, well, that's what I get.
That's
all
not the critical question for this group, but.
Apparently other people thought it was critical. I don't know. I mean, what kind of study do you guys want to design to study debris loading?
Well, we didn't. I guess I didn't think of it as a, is it critical to design a study? Is it a critical information need in order to design this fish passage solution kind of project?
And so would you, you gave it a low at Foster because we're thinking of spill and not of a screen, where debris is a bigger problem with the screen.
Probably.
Even gets to 50% is covered.
Yeah, just a point of clarification, because we've been bouncing around a lot today. I mean, in the meeting purpose, it talks about current research questions critical to completing designs. This says a critical information need. We've talked about critical uncertainties, and those are three very different things in my mind. So
you want
maybe
define,
we should
can you define what
back up a step, and I mean, maybe it's too late for this, but but I don't know.
Let's come back tomorrow.
I think it would be helpful to go through project by project. I mean, because the needs are clearly different across projects, and maybe pick one and focus on what this says are the critical needs, and do we agree with it at that project?
I guess if I was thinking, I mean, do they have any sort of feeling of aha, or are they somewhat consistent with our prior perspectives or not? So if you took the Detroit and you looked at the two highest critical needs according to people as ore bay abundance, and then the other one is hydraulic setting on fish performance. Below that, it looks like the percentage has dropped into the 50s. Where's the next highest one? 56%? contribution of life histories and survival of small fish in the reservoir. So are we surprised that forbay abundance is a high consideration at Detroit, as well as hydraulic performance over other factors, or is that sort of a not so surprising?
Hydraulic setting makes sense because you kind of want to know where the fish are moving in relation to the flow, but I don't know about the four-bay abundance.
Yeah, I'm wondering if everyone was consistent on how they approached this, because I heard a lot of comments around me. I actually declined answering this one, but you know, whether or not someone thought the information need was already met good enough made it a issue on some, in some instances. So some people may think, just purely, is it important to know four-bay abundance? Well, sure. But someone may have answered, say, Lookout Point or somewhere else where they were a little bit, or, you know, one of the other projects where they may have already known enough about it.
I'm not surprised by those two categories. For designing a surface collector in the Detroit four-bay, like we talked, it could be, very useful to know the four-bay abundance if we're going to be doing a trap and haul. It would help us design and size the facility correctly. Hydraulic information will also help us design and place that facility appropriately to have the right target collection efficiency.
Right, but do you see my point though? If someone had come in, if let's say for example at Detroit we've already done hydraulic setting, all of that's been done, would you have maybe said, well, it's a low priority? Yeah, see, and I think some people did one of two things. They either said, fundamentally, this is a good question, or they said, we already know enough about it. So there's some of that going on in here.
I was hoping that it would be one of the, it was critical information we still needed to know.
Yeah, that's right. What I thought we were talking about.
Yeah.
So it was known, it was no longer critical.
Well, I don't think it was
Maybe this isn't the place, and we can talk about it at our next RMNE meeting, but I'm struggling with this need to understand the abundance in order to design trap and haul. Because whatever you're seeing now is very likely different from what it's going to be once you actually have passage and more fish are going up there, potentially. I mean, who knows how the environment's going to affect that in the future. And so I think actually doing a study to estimate abundance in the four-bay is one approach. There might be better approaches in terms of looking at what is the recovery goal for up there and what potentially could you see in terms of production based on that. Or I mean, there's other ways to look at that that don't require a multi-year study.
Yeah, there could be.
Yeah. I mean, could you interpret that as at least a lot of people sitting around the room think that the survival through the reservoir part is at least a surmountable challenge, and they're leaping ahead to what are the specific things you need to do to get them out of the reservoir four-bay?
Yes, it could. At Detroit.
Yeah, we'll just talk about Detroit. Okay. I was just struck by how, you know, these questions are, you know, depending upon which phase you're in. Have you decided what method you're going to use?
Right.
Then you'd have one set of critical priorities. But if you've already decided kind of what that method is, then you kind of automatically just swing your brain to, okay, what are the critical elements for figuring out how to make that work? So
right.
You get a different list, and then if you got that one done, then you'd probably be worried about a third tier of things, which is, well, how well might it work, and what would your performance be?
But I think we did think like that. I mean, I think people who are, you know, in the middle of all this thought, okay, we've already pretty much decided we're going to have to do an at dam collector in Detroit and Cougar. So, but you know, there is that question, do you have to do four-bay abundance? You definitely need to do something with hydraulics and something with, you know, where. How do you locate this facility so that you will attract the fish? I don't know. I mean, maybe rather than argue over whether we need to evaluate 4-bay abundance, maybe we could talk about, well, if we did all decide that it was a priority, how would we do it? Could you do it by just subtracting out, if you had abundance of fish at the head of the reservoir and you did have some way to estimate reservoir mortality, then you'd know how many you would expect to get in the 4-bay.
Or hydroacoustics.
That doesn't give you future conditions.
Well, and I think, too, that there's different elements of that, like reservoir survival. That's one of the elements you're getting at. The other one is the horizontal and vertical 4-bay distribution. That's the other element. So I don't know what abundance has to do.
Sounded to me, and again, I can ask the stupid questions here because I don't meddle with your stuff. If you're trying to size the facility on the back end, how many fish you need to be able to hold and store until you can transport them or whatever you're going to do with them, then that's where the abundance piece would come in. But I do agree that rather than a study, there's probably just some paper calculation exercises you could use with recovery plan goals, and you could double those for a safety factor, make some assumptions about, based on other populations, how many fry or smolts are those, is that likely to produce, and that might give you a sense of how many total there are. I know we were looking at this with White River Project internally, and I think we were figuring out that if you take, well, this isn't quite right, because we were trying to size an adult facility, figuring out how many adults we needed to pass. But if you took the whole distribution of fish over the year, juveniles, at other projects, you can kind of get a sense for, what is the maximum proportion of that overall total that you're ever going to see on a given day. It might be 5% of the whole run is the max you ever see, it might be 10%, but, you're not going to get 90% of the migration passing, especially if they're rearing in reservoirs. So I think there's maybe some ways you can go about figuring out the appropriate scale of the facility.
No, I think, Mike, and you bring up a good point. There could be different ways of approaching this. We haven't really wrestled with trying to look at 4-bay abundance.
Yeah.
So that's interesting in itself.
Actually, we have.
I'm not entirely
from a
research
perspective. I threw together the Clackamas stuff.
I know, we talked about it several years ago.
We've talked about different paper ways to do it, and it's kind of like, it's a simple paper exercise, and then it comes up, the Clackamas night, because you guys are interested in the run timing relative to numbers, because that gives you how many you have to fit in a box at once, right?
Right.
So then it becomes, the Clackamas might not be representative of Detroit. The South Stadium may be more representative. And it's like, then... I don't know how you resolve those issues when we keep coming up with reasons not to use some of the information we have to make a reasonable guess.
Okay.
And I guess that's not what today's purpose is, but...
I like, John, the way you kind of set us up, just kind of scanning these columns just to do the check-in. Are there things people think are critical that aren't highlighted, or... trying to hone down just to a few that we can talk study designs about.
Well, let's continue with the Detroit then. So, right now the two high priorities are the 4-bay abundance and hydraulics vis-a-vis the survey. Are there any surprises in terms of what people thought would be high that aren't? You would have thought for sure something would have popped up to the top and it's not.
I think the discussion we had about the pulsing operations there, peaking operations, could be an influence on ultimately design of that facility.
The hydraulic setting?
I guess it could fall into the effects of operations.
On passage timing?
Success.
Yeah.
I think for some of the ones at the top for relating to timing and survival, there might have been a mixture of how people selected their ones and twos around the room for whether their knowledge of whether a study was already completed, hence we don't need the information, versus whether it's still important and we could continue further years of collection on timing and survival at the six locations.
I think that was Melissa's point.
Yeah.
But other than that, I don't know if there's other major study needs.
that I can think of for the core.
I mean, to me, the difficulty with Detroit is in knowing where to locate a facility and how to get the hydraulics so that it will attract fish. And you're not going to know that until you build something. I mean, that's part of our issue with the PFFC is it's giving us some information, but because it's so much smaller than a full-size facility, it's not creating the hydraulics that we hope would attract a large percent of fish. So, I mean, I don't know, John, how do you do it other than in a hydraulic model?
That's the first order.
That's Detroit.
Well, maybe disagree a little in terms of doing it. You can't do it until you put something out there.
I mean, we've used a spillway.
The spillway is what I was thinking of.
And that's been helpful.
Yeah.
Well, have you thought about using a facility at Vicksburg to model this? Or
it hasn't come up for some time. Originally, I think Jim may have mentioned it.
I've brought it up.
Is there anything to model?
There aren't any models built.
We don't have any models for the one.
No, I understand that, but... when you're siting something big like this, and you don't know where you need to put it and what the circulation patterns are, I mean, that seems like a good expenditure of effort.
I think it is.
Yeah.
And we all get to go to Mississippi then.
In August. Make sure you schedule a trip for August.
I thought you guys did have some hydraulic modeling.
Well, because you have an August.
CF. Yeah. It's a cougar. It's a
cougar.
CFD. Right. We have some CFD models, but not physical.
Yeah.
Want to go to the next project?
Yeah. What about the office? So let me ask a couple more questions on the same project. In converse, the highest non-critical is the debris loading. Does that make sense?
Yes, there's not a whole lot of debris at Detroit to worry about.
All right. What's the next highest in that category? It looks like survival through the existing routes and 4-bay entry time are 60% non-critical.
We already know that the survival.
So that rings true? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, then let's go to Foster then. The highest rank up there for criticals, I'm seeing, is 75%, and that's movement patterns in the reservoir. Followed by 69% effects of operations on passage success.
Right, and we are collecting that data now. We don't have it all ready yet, but we are collecting it, so it is a data need.
Actually, the effects of operations on passage time is
71.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I know, I am. I'm just pulling here.
No, that's fine. Again, the zones seem to ring true, it sounds like.
Yes, because we are testing the operations on passage and their movement patterns in the reservoir. So those look right. Those look good. Those are the data needs.
That's the one system where we're using operations for.
Correct. Yeah, that's the one where we're doing operations more than any of the other systems.
Is there something that a little bit were surprised as well?
Not for Foster, no. Do you guys...
Why would the abundance be so high there? I know it just seems like if you're not planning any trap and haul there, why would that even come into play?
Oh, the 4-bay abundance? Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't see that one, 67%. Because we're talking about a volitional passage over, you know, operational spillway or weir. I suppose that would inform our, if we were building a new fish weir the size or something like that, but yeah, it's not, I don't know that it's that critical. What do you think, Fred?
Well, it looks like it got ranked high across every
project. It did,
every
it did.
Project, so
except for Cougar.
Yeah,
except for
Cougar.
Yeah.
No, it's high there, too.
Look out this...
Yeah.
What is Lakota's 58? 58%?
Including your
A. Oh,
accurate. In other words, by not including the NA in your percentages for the critical or non-critical, you're unfairly weighting it when more people don't answer the question.
Yeah, that's true.
So in other words, that 10% could be two people out of this entire room think that, you know, horizontal and vertical order distribution for cougar is critical, right?
Yeah, so where you have a high NA percentage,
you're
skeptical.
Well, I guess generally what I'm suggesting is that if your entire percentages for all three of your columns should add up to 100 as opposed to the first two adding up to 100, and then just NA is not even relevant. But it is relevant when you look at, you know, when you have a, for example, in Detroit, if you go down to the 83% for the critical, 33% put a question mark. So,
right.
And there's probably no statistical difference between 10 and 90% when it's just, what, 8 people?
Right, so, yeah, I mean, I get the purpose of scoring or ranking them, but at the same time, is there importance to the weight?
Yeah, you might have to take some of the people to solve.
This is just a fun thing to do.
The rest of your guys is really bad.
A lot of people bail on hydraulics.
Okay, that's the one person. Did you do it?
Yeah.
15
and 16.
I'll get a response. I can tell you this.
I'm just looking at the sheer number of NAs, and the 15 and 16, a lot of people. A lot of people got.
And she's.
Well,
it
wasn't.
Well, I'm starting to interpret that. Downstream passage RNA needs versus facility design needs.
I was wondering who that dude is, because that's the one person I don't.
Are we going faster than
this? We are. We're good to go. I think so.
Are we on cougar?
It looks like we're right in the middle of the crack there, but it looks like Orbe Abundance is given the red.
I guess we're
60-something percent. And then life history contribution, the second one.
Our screen
just has this line right through the middle.
Can you freeze the pain?
I freeze the pain.
Just hide Foster Collins.
Oh. Okay. Are these called?
All right. So 67% Forbe abundance.
I would raise the same questions about that as we did at Detroit.
Except that cougar, we would want to know. Where's John?
I guess
you agree with that?
I would reiterate the discussion we had, and it should come back to: is there?
I know it's throwing darts, but
the ability to begin looking at that.
Makes sense.
But we
to
think it relates to design.
And why not? How many fish would it have to move out?
Yeah. Makes sense.
Multiple.
Why do you need to know? I mean, all you do is you just put another truck up there, or you fill your hopper, and if the hopper fills faster than you expected, you take two trucks. You recycle it more frequently.
Unless the hopper fills. Hopper fills for 3 hours, and your crews show up once a day.
Well, then you hire the crews to be there all day long. I mean, what are they doing at Baker? They're getting, how many fish have they gotten in a single day there? Thousands. Somehow they're managing to trap them all. They're not doubling the size of their hopper. They just operate more frequently. I mean, I understand that,
But we can talk to Ed and see how they did. I mean, how they did decide how big of a size. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the size they picked is sufficient.
Most of the time,
are they running fish over the top of their collection?
No, but they have to increase the frequency. They have to put extra crews on during the peak of the season.
Yeah,
right. But you don't want to overbuild it. You don't want to build it so that You only get, you know.
Well, yeah,
you have
no,
to fill
good
it up
point.
And you've got these crews sitting around.
I can't speak to it. I'm not the engineer. It's something we'll want to come back to, and maybe what you're saying, you can convince them that's
but,
not an issue.
You know, and it is, it's still like, it's the same thing Richie said before. You might be able to calculate a paper exercise instead of, I mean, you know, we've got that problem of how do you know what there, what's there today is going to be representative of what you're going to have in 5 years after you build a thing.
But do you need a means of knowing that when you built it to get collection efficiency?
No.
No.
Not really. You don't
well,
need
this, is, this is about safely holding and moving fish, I mm-hmm. think.
Yes.
Not
yes.
so much about efficiencies.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I have a question that's coming from ignorance, which is when I look at the cougar columns, the majority of the high scores are in the non-critical column, which mm-hmm. says to me that people in the room don't think that any of these are priorities for Cougar, and therefore, what do people think the priority is for Cougar?
Just build it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We know. Yeah. We have enough.
Than they do anywhere else.
What that means is we have enough information to know what we need. Yeah.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
But this is what you know. We've gotten to earlier in the day, in that. You know, what are these critical information needs in order to go ahead with building it? And there's red squares in Cougar under critical. I mean, do we truly consider those critical information needs in order to design this facility?
You're referring to 4B abundance and life history contributions?
Which
exactly.
people already said are not critical in terms of in terms of designing a facility.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's all relative to Cougar itself. It's mm-hmm. not trying to, and it didn't consider, well, we would generally agree. We've been saying that as well. This was just ranking of these categories for Cougar. This is what came out. So for Cougar, I would generally agree. I don't know that our PDT has critical information needs to begin design. What they need is dollars.
And that's been unrecorded, right?
Say your name.
Okay. Let's move to the next question. Lookout point.
So we got a collection jar. We'll pass it around.
Why is there nothing for horizontal and vertical? That one, why don't you have any?
We ran out of time.
Oh, okay. Have you done it now? Have you done that all
Is this not a missing
is it
formula or something? Yeah.
No, we just didn't get that tallied. So we could talk about it. I mean, for lookout, I mean, like we talked earlier, the Corsi's reservoir survival is the first step in the logic of looking at passage in the system.
Yes.
Before that, I mean, without that, we wouldn't want to jump to horizontal and vertical four-bay distribution necessarily. Yeah. Yeah, movement patterns. Survival came out high, but
operations is a high one too.
Yeah.
Both of the operations.
It seems consistent with what we were talking about.
Yeah.
Just a little less certainty that we know what we're doing there, or what the fish are doing.
Here. Yeah, there's less certainty for sure. There's less certainty in the middle four, in Cougar, or lookout point.
We just punted the studies there later because they were later in the buyout for 2 weeks.
So, Rich, with respect to the in-reservoir survival and lookout, do you think that we also need to assess pre-specific survival below Dexter? Because those are essentially the two choices that we're facing with there. The trade-off between moving fry from the head of reservoir to the river versus allowing them to pass through the reservoir. Just wondering if that's another study that we should consider.
Well, I guess I would take it in that order. If we could look at lookout first, answer that question, If we're then considering at dam passage, then you would want to look at Dexter to know if you're going to consider passing them into the Dexter pool. Or did I not understand?
No, I was saying you need to know what the survival pit is in the reservoir versus in the river below the dams.
Oh, okay.
With the peer review study.
To compare a trend like fall?
Yeah.
Well,
just what that's costing.
Your mixing assumption will be violated if you do that.
And that, I mean, that kind of gets, that's a good point, Richie, and that was one thing that I know that, John, you're talking about, and I don't know exactly which model fits what we've been doing with the paired release, but, you know, we know that we're not meeting the mixing assumptions, but that was part of, I mean, I think that's part of the thing we're asking. If you do, to compare head of reservoir collection to in-reservoir rearing, the fish don't mix. You know, if you collect the fish in April and May and move them around, they go down the lower Willamette, the main stem Willamette, you know, in May, June. And then the fish that go in the reservoir, they're not going to come out until much later in the fall. And so their conditions in the main stem Willamette are going to be different. So to me, that's what you're testing. Not only how well do they survive in the reservoir, but also, you know, are they getting better conditions downstream or not? And I mean, that was one thing I wanted to look at with the results from this paired release study so far is, you know, when were the different groups released and what kind of flow conditions or temperature conditions did they experience in the main stem? Is that what we would expect if we actually had a head of reservoir collector? Is that when we would be releasing the fish there or not? Because I think, at least in a couple of years, remember you're doing your releases in the tail race.
In May.
Yeah. So would that represent when you'd normally be doing them if you had a full head reservoir? But when were you releasing the in-reservoir fish?
Same day.
Yeah.
Well, do we need the below dam survival? In my mind, the critical question is reservoir survival. If it's high enough, we're then looking at questions at the dam regarding passage. If it's too low, then it becomes more important because you have to consider head of reservoir moving fry downstream, and they're going to be probably rearing as they move downstream, so that survival becomes more important. I guess it's in that order, reservoir survival. First, you don't have to look downstream if that reservoir survival turns out okay.
So I think Tom is suggesting using the downstream below Dexter survival as your comparison threshold. Because you're saying, is it okay or not okay, but what's that line? And if you had a reference point of what's the downstream option survival, you know, you could say if it's better than that, you put it...
Yeah, that's essentially what I was saying.
Put the passage here. Works.
So if you take fish out of lookout point, wherever you get them, are you saying you're still trying to decide whether or not just to put them right below lookout point or whether to put them below Dexter?
Below Dexter.
Mm-hmm. You would only, I mean, that seems like a logical thing, right?
Yeah.
Reality check. It's already piping
up. Yeah.
Like, why would you do that?
No, I guess I can see some value where you're comparing in the survival estimate from passing through lookout to survival of a similar sized group of fish released below from Dexter to Willamette Falls. You could look at the relative survival that way.
I was getting at which risk is worse, putting
fry
collected at the head of the reservoir into the main stem river below versus allowing them to go into the predator-infested
reservoir. Well, that brings up, to my mind, another way of comparing could be lookout point compared to another reservoir. Ideally, where we have a population we've got genetic pedigrees showing there near replacement, so that would be like Foster or Detroit. If the reservoir survival between those systems is similar, if we have replacement at Foster and Detroit from genetic pedigree, and you have then compared the survival of the reservoirs between Lookout and those two, then you have reason to think you can get self-sustaining population.
What years of adult returns do you have when you make that statement that you're a replacement? What adult return years support that statement?
It's for Detroit, we have 1 year so far.
What year's return?
2009.
2009 through 2014
returns. Yeah.
So it's a full cohort of fours and fives from the 2009 brood.
We have 2 years waiting for that kind of work at Foster. Okay. Just the one cohort return of 09 for 4 years.
Okay.
Nothing for Lookout.
I was just curious because, you know, Ocean's doing this all the time. We're expecting it to do that a little bit next year.
And we really don't need anything for Lookout because we know we put 4,000 fish to spawn up there and we get 100 back as adults 4 and 5 years later.
Yeah.
So we're nowhere near replacement. So it's
with the structures and what's there now. Yes. Yeah. I figured that probably Mark or you would be looking for structures or some way to improve things. Because that was tricky because, I mean, just the way they're using those systems in time and space, it's kind of one of those, any way you study it, it's wrong. If you put fry in the top end of the reservoir and fry below, then you've got the lag in time of 2 to 3 months. So you're really not doing apples to apples. Mm-hmm. If you do different sizes, then you're using different fish. So that's really not apples to apples. Try to mimic it. I don't know if you could release two groups of fry, try to recapture fish from the reservoir at the appropriate time several months later.
That the first group is coming down?
Mark them and re-release them below so you could get comparative survival estimates to the Willamette.
Back to your question, what are you really trying to compare? Is it location, but is it also the differential timing?
Well, I think that's
is that part of the treatment?
Right.
You know?
Well, I think kind of what you want to know, maybe, when you take a stab at this, is you want to know if you had good passage in the reservoir, whatever that is, what is the best payoff for fish coming down the river to the reservoir? Do you get more smolts if you grab them at the top of the reservoir, release them below to continue migrating? Actually, adult returns, even, you really need that. Or do you let them go in the reservoir and move them after that point?
Well, isn't that an easier question? Just ask, all the different ways of handling fish, what gets you the greatest proportion of fish down to, say, what, Willamette Dam? It doesn't matter, you know, what you manipulate in time or space or both, but what's the thing that gets the most juveniles down to? Well, and I'm using that because that's your base of detection. Right. So it doesn't matter whether it's big fish, small fish, early, late, up, down, it's whatever the process is. And then all you want to do is make sure that you're not mixing up apples and oranges by having different recovery rates when they happen. Because one group could come down when the water's fast and the detection efficiency is low. Another one could come down later when the water's lower and have higher detection efficiency and get a confounded result. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Adult returns, that sort of washes, but you're waiting 5 years.
Yeah.
You know?
But that is a confounding factor. I mean, if you have, total number of around 75% survival rate to the downstream release, you have to weight that by what you think their survival likely would be going on. Because small fish going to the estuary are going to survive at a lower rate than bigger later.
So what about getting getting better estimates of efficiency at Willamette Falls? I mean, that's what sparked this whole thing here was, it is true that if the fish are coming down at different times, you probably have different detection efficiency at Willamette Falls based on the flows. So is there a way we could do a better expansion with the juvenile detection to make those more comparable?
Yeah, through my career, I've seen lots of studies where we've used this relative recoveries, and the results are just backwards to what they actually are when you apply the efficiency correction, and it's dramatic. I mean, it's just dramatic. Like, hey, we did this 3 times, it always gets the same pattern. It's always the same unadjusted wrong path, you know?
It's consistent, it's just
not accurate. Yeah, consistently
biased.
Yes. And, you know, the efficiency release is one thing, but just raising the efficiency at the dam itself from 10% to 20% does not get you away from that problem.
Right, that's true.
Yeah. It gives you better numbers, but you still have to adjust for the time varying rates down there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's what you need, right? Time varying rates.
Time varying rates. How do you do that?
Exactly. Right. And that's what you guys have been
proposing
for a while.
Well, I think it's the efficiency releases that John talked about, and then we're doing the model based. If you don't want to keep doing those in perpetuity, we're relating those efficiencies to flows or other environmental covariates.
But somebody, I know that when we talked about the design, one of the arguments against it was, well, if you're releasing, to do an efficiency test, you release fish like at the head of the Fore Bay at Willamette Falls, they're not going to behave as the fish are coming from the Middle Fork.
Well, I mean, no, it's true. You have to, between the devil and deep blue sea, and you put them too close to the dam, the air can go through the dam like they normally should.
Right.
Put them too far away from the dam, now they're going to have some mortality.
Right.
So your estimate's biased. So pick your poison.
That's right.
Which bias
do you not do it at all, or do you just go ahead and assume you've got some?
Well, we did do it in the past, and we released the fish several miles above the dam in the middle of the river and assumed that they would distribute more or less evenly by the time we got there. I think that made the most sense to us.
And there's a bend, so they have a chance to swirl around.
And sometimes people will release fish, free places or something across the river or whatever you think makes sense.
Well, and do you guys have from your acoustic work, do you know which, at least for those tagged fish, can you identify what part of the main stem they were in when they were in that area? Like, did they all hug the right bank or the left bank?
So we had arrays with several hydrophones across the Willamette River at several locations. But I think every hydrophone can hear every tag from any part of the river, so I don't know if we can really separate that stuff out.
Oh, really? I thought you had 3D detection, but you could tell me exactly where
in the Fore Bay.
The Fore Bay.
You do it all day long. Yeah, but not in the
Okay. All right.
Yeah. We could do that.
Well, yes, we can do that. We can do that.
So, in a way, we're kind of getting back to a different concept. Rich was pushing for the reservoir survival itself, which is, they're different kind of questions. And do we want to talk about how could you do a better reservoir survival study? I know that Fred or somebody at one of the breaks was talking about parental based tanking.
We wrote a proposal up in the past based on some of the work that John had done. So that's out there.
Where you release the fish up in the tributaries and you capture them at the screw traps at the head of the reservoirs. And then can you tag those again and do another recapture? Would that help get that reservoir mortality?
Yes, possibly. As part of you have to have the whole design out there, but there's places that maybe slice and dice things slightly better. It also depends on, again, the size of the fish. The efficiency releases, if the fish are larger when they get to, then you could maybe use acoustic tags as part of that process.
Mm-hmm.
So you could use acoustic tags down for efficiency, but also see if there's mortality, or where you want to release the tag so that there's very little mortality, and what you're seeing is really just efficiency. I think there's ways to skin the cat, different ways, that's, you play the game, at least initially,
Yeah, I don't know where these fish are in the water column down in the Fore Bay, but I know Dick Ledgerwood was playing around with a contraption down the estuary where basically... Well, he built a little contraption. It was kind of almost a raft, and you could basically, it was pulling water through, and you could divert it up over a stream into a catch basin. He could
down the estuary, he was driving that thing around with a couple of boats and actually catching pit tag fish. He had a hooked up to a pit tag detector and was, you know, able to recapture fish. So I don't know. I mean, there's different ways of trying to get your hands on fish that aren't necessarily just heaving big nets out there and seeing them up if people are adverse to that. There's also, I think, some pit tag detection capabilities. We're starting to have some success with these, you know, kind of big open pit tag detectors down there. We're starting to get some adult, they were designed for adult detections, you know, hanging them off of pile dikes and stuff, trying to get adults coming back. We're starting to get a few.
Yep.
You know, it's not working great, but considering that we've got really, you know, one 10-foot by 20-foot panel out there, we're getting 2 or 3% of all the adults that pass Bonneville. That's not bad. But the kind of surprising part of that is we're actually picking up some juvenile detections, too, on the back side of those. So those are pretty cheap. I mean, right now, he's using garden hose and stuff. So.
He gave a presentation to the R&E team. We thought that, you know, attaching those to boat docks and stuff, you could put a whole bunch of those in. And who knows what you'd get, but you'd get some.
Yeah, so anyway, my only point in that ramble was that there may be some, if you need alternative detection sites, there may be ways to get pit tag detections in other places beyond just the conventional kind of flat plate, you know, stuff that we're doing now. And that wouldn't be horribly expensive either.
Trawl.
And he talked about the trawl. Yeah. Or the ski boat.
And John,
ski boat.
You would essentially be able to tell us what kind of detection rate you would need to have in order to have a valid analysis.
We
power.
On the CBR DART website, we have sample size programs for single release, paired release, relative recovery, triple release models, the trip pip stuff. So it's all interactive. You can go in, sort of say this is how many reaches or this is how many periods, and put in different sample sizes, and they'll give you precision curves on the fly.
But if we have to go to some of these, maybe, you know, portable
pit. Yeah. I mean, it depends on the design. So the plastic designs we have already.
If we're only detecting 2% or 1% of the fish, how do we know when enough is enough to have a
well,
well, you can put that in. I mean, that's your test.
We'll try to do it at very low sizes. Yeah. And you have some issues that the precision programs that we use for sample size don't capture when you have very small sizes, because what happens is you get sparse data at some point. Certain capture histories don't exist. So what theoretically is decimal is not calculable anymore. Mm-hmm. So the theoretical models sort of don't really work at the bottom when you scrape at the bottom of the detections.
Yeah. Okay.
But we can tell you when you're getting close to the dome's touch zone.
Right.
Okay. But there is a lot of software there out there that will help you with that. And then for more handcrafted designs, we just do it ourselves. And that's what we're here. That's why we have the BPA project to help people with.
So yeah, if we were to improve the infrastructure, pit tags could be used as an approach to look at lookout point reservoir survival and other downstream reach survival.
And we're doing certain exercises now looking at what sort of what-if scenarios in terms of changes in pit tag configurations and how they would affect detection rates and precision in the river anyhow. So we're equipped to do that. That's sort of what we do. It's boring. We're really boring people. But we like it.
So you fit right in.
Yeah. Okay. Are we done with this? I hate to push things along, but we sort of got distracted.
I thought it was a good discussion.
No, it was a very good discussion.
Yeah.
Are we up to Lookout Point or is it Hills Creek?
I'm just wondering did we reach any kind of consensus about at least for reservoir mortality type studies, and then maybe, you know, going back to the, it's related, but the getting information on head of reservoir surrogate passage. I mean, it seemed to me that I know Rich made a real good pitch that he wanted to first look at reservoir survival before doing anything else. But since we've already started looking at, you know, what would happen if you had head of reservoir collection, it seems like you could be doing those concurrently and get different information that could help lead towards making a decision, do we go at dam or the reservoir?
So my opinion is we're looking at how alternative handlings of the fish affect downstream survival.
Right.
Say to again, the issue again is that heterogeneity and detection probabilities. It's going to occur because the fish aren't going through at the same time, by design almost, right? But the only way to do it then is with some efficiency releases. The question is how best to do those. You know, design-based or not design-based, pit tag alone, maybe a goose tag conjunction. And those are things I think that are not that hard to say, but here's the three alternatives of what's the good, bad, and the ugly of the three. The relative cost, and those are fairly straightforward kind of questions. And that could be, we'll talk about that in a little while, what are some of the deliverables we want from me. That could be one of the things we want me to address.
Yeah,
I think it is.
You know, I'm not saying it is, but, you know, it could be.
I guess I just was thinking, I mean, we've talked about different study methods mm-hmm. and in the team, too, and we haven't brought them all up here. Maybe it'd be useful to kind of say, well, here's some different ideas.
Yeah.
Which do you think are the good, bad, and ugly of these ideas, or what can we do to make some of these better?
Yeah, the hope was maybe we still have it. Yeah, pick one of these high priority studies and then say, okay, let's do it. You know, or let's consider how we do it. How is it currently being done, or if it is being done, what are the alternatives? Have we picked? I don't think we come up with a favorite yet, have we?
No, but I think let's have that discussion step, and I think that's a good way to move ahead here. Do you have some?
You
and I just talked about two different. If you're just reservoir, there is a way to do it with just two unique batches of fish. You're still using hatchery fish,
mm-hmm.
but it's one way of doing a study to get reservoir-specific survival. It has the limitations of using hatchery fish, but there's you got to pick your poison.
I think that's similar to what I was thinking we previously talked about, having hatchery marked fish that we release into the tributary and then we
that is very similar.
Like that.
Is there small hatcheries also? Hatchery fish, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems is the release period you're talking about is only a few weeks apart. So that's the only area, that's the only time period you can calculate survival. So, but we can discuss.
What would be the mark technique on that?
What's that?
Just be a batch mark?
Well, the first batch would have to be parental-based tags, and then the second batch would be adclipped or whatever. So your second group of fish would be distinguished from your first group of fish.
How would you distinguish between your PBT fish and the wild fish?
With the parental mark tag. That's you have to run it on wild, whatever clips you have on wild.
Okay.
On any clip.
The lethal sampling those.
Good.
You're genotyping the parents, Rich.
No, I guess
parents of those fish.
Yeah, you're just using the thing that if you can figure out a way to take on a gill net to figure out how to get the fish.
I'm sort of surprised that Hill Creek result. We have much stronger opinions about what we shouldn't be doing than what we should be doing.
Well, partly that's there.
Using the reasoning earlier about all the greens, it looks like we're ready to implement fish passage at Hills Creek, too. Right?
Well, look at 44, lots of people had no opinion on Hills Creek. They're like, where the hell's that?
It wouldn't make much sense.
Way up there.
Once at the Hills Creek before we get lookout point master fix.
Yeah, that's. I think that part of that was more, you know, it's
the main
a lower priority because it's down the road.
No, it's on the road. The green feeder isn't on the road. You notice that green feeder is not here at all.
Right.
Yeah. It's on the road, just down the road.
Green okay. So we're not doing anything in Hills Creek. How about Fall Creek? We got, what's the third? Reservoir survival. Yeah.
How's that match? That makes sense.
Well, it's just reservoir survival for the little guys. As well, it's there for the green ones, it's not a number.
The Corps hasn't been thinking of needing to do anything in particular. We have an ongoing operation there. We're not being asked to do something different yet, so we don't see it as a priority. But if you're just thinking about Fall Creek itself, having that information could help improve what we're doing there.
And I think, if you look at the three red or semi-red boxes in there, that's what I heard Stephanie talking about earlier was, if there was an opportunity to change operations and look at survival in there, then maybe what's going on right now is the best possible scenario, but maybe there's something that can be done to improve it.
Yeah, what we're doing is all we can do in terms of it's consistent with all the other missions. There isn't another operation that doesn't have an impact, so we would have to work out, is there something we think would really be worth doing, and then work with management.
Right, but you wouldn't work to change it unless you had data saying that there was some other operation that could actually, provide better survival.
I will just also say for the record, if this kind of operation is going to continue with lamprey being put up there, and then juveniles coming down into the reservoir with this rapid release of water and the declining elevation, they have a chance to be impacting lamprey. And I know they're not listed, but it's something worth considering.
Put that on the critical uncertainty list. Study it.
Yeah, of course they have 5,000.
Leave them high and dry.
And then you dewater them.
And then you dewater them. We're looking at what the effects of that in the main stuff right now.
Just keep it
running through. There's your flood
control. We're like halfway to the beach.
No, we're not. I'm talking steady designs for research priorities.
Aren't we?
Yeah, I'm
getting ready to wrap
this up. There's a reason for the core census
I just
four.
Haven't worked really great.
Not studying 4 Bay in 3 times and Fall Street. They're really high. Okay. That makes sense. Well, we have roughly a half hour left. It doesn't mean we have to, but we have about a half hour left before we promise to depart. We have two possibilities. One is a study objective to try to discuss how we might design like a reservoir, or we can try to talk about what's the next step, any next step in this forum. And what kind of output would you like to see from this process? I'm supposed to provide a deliverable. I can make one up, but it may not be of your thinking.
I wouldn't mind a little bit more discussion of the ideas on reservoir survival and some of the discussion from Fred on the two batches.
You want
to
do that?
I wouldn't.
You ready to do
these
that?
Numbers might make sense to you. They came from somebody.
But which?
Three years ago. Oh God.
Is there a particular model for the?
Staggered entry.
Well, let's start. I'm sorry. I'm a simple person. What are we talking about? So real small guys, or
we're starting from Fry to R. So basically, it's time period, not distance, not location here. So April to July is kind of how one way to think of it. What's the survival of Bishop in that time period?
Okay.
Any particular reservoir line?
I guess lookout point.
Okay.
So the idea could be to release 100,000 or whatever Fry in April. Do a collection in July,
a second batch of fish that are ad-clipped some way to tell them apart from the first group. And then you do more collections in, say, September and October. And it is basically that design. Maybe not that one. It's the two-release staggered entry.
So we'd have 100,000 in April, and then when's the second release?
July.
July. Again, some order of magnitude.
100,000, yeah. It doubles, I guess, it depends on our, what we think, if we capture those.
And then you would do subsequent time captures after that?
My understanding is the first capture event would have to occur right before you release the second batch.
Wouldn't have to. No, you wouldn't have to.
You wouldn't have to. Okay.
If you're interested,
sometime in July would be the first recapture when you're releasing those segments.
Yeah, because you'd want to, if you, I'm going to repeat what I think I heard. So you're releasing 100,000 fish in April, another 100,000 in July. The purpose of what then is always to survival between release points, so you're trying to get the survival between April and July, and then you could have recovery periods post that second release. You want to have enough time for the fish to mix, right? Do you want both groups to have equal detection rates, so you want to give them enough time to shake and mix,
right,
and for a few weeks, and then you can have recaptures end of July, so on and so forth, so forth,
yes,
through time, and with the idea of estimating survival in that April to July period.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all happening within the reservoir.
Within the reservoir.
So it's
and
not
ideally
location,
done by
it's
October.
Time, as you said, I guess.
Yeah. And I was thinking it'd be done by October before fish really starts leaving the system, because I imagine that would throw in a heat if you have groups leaving, but maybe not. But anyway, you could have it done by, October, as long as they're mixed.
So that wouldn't account, if I'm thinking about it correctly, that would estimate the joint probability of remaining in the reservoir and surviving, so it would include fish that actually kind of, if they're passing the dam during that period, that would be incorporated into the estimate of survival.
Or not surviving, yes.
Or not surviving.
Yeah. Uh-huh. If there's passive.
Right, that's why I'm hoping to do it in these time periods, and we don't expect, there's not a lot of fish leaving it from what all the evidence shows during the time period we're talking here. In the summer, they're just not leaving. So it would be a potential bias, but I don't think there's much of it happening.
So and when we sample the second pair, these are two different batch mark groups.
Yes.
And they would be resampled destructively or non-destructively?
No. The only way I think of doing this is destructively.
Okay. It doesn't honestly really matter.
I mean, I'm a pacifist. I'd like to go
We'll tell everyone you tried.
I heard you say that. They are hatchery fish. You're relevant.
So what method, Fred, do you think?
Well, the most effective way we have that's been working is with gill nets. And we can catch, hundreds of them. So I think, depending on how much effort we put in it, we could get the recapture numbers we need to get the precision we want around any estimate.
Where?
What?
Where?
Where would you
everywhere.
We put nets everywhere, assuming it's based on John's work, they swim everywhere, and they're mixed everywhere.
Do you have to be concerned with, through the season, sampling at the same specific location, or a relative location, or is it changing in size?
I think as long as, again, I'm not an expert in this yet, but I think the idea is as long as you are you're random in where you're sampling.
Well, they're mixed.
Yeah. And then the assumption that fish are mixed, so.
But it doesn't your assumption
actually,
that your catch rate is
nice
similar? You have to assume catch rate is or similar?
Well, I don't think the catch rate would be I don't know what you mean by that, I guess. There's going to be fish dying, so your catch rate of one group is.
No, basically, if they could be different if you're using a gill net of a different size.
Right, and we use experimental gill nets that we think like that about the size that are there. So I don't think catchability based on size would matter.
Yeah,
So is there also the assumption? Is there also the assumption that the survival is common between two groups after the point of the release of the second group?
That's the only thing you can do to get something out of this.
Yeah. So the whole post-release handling mortality, veterans versus virgins, is probably a real issue here as well. Maybe since those fish. That first release group of fish would have been at liberty for much, much longer, and you might likely have some.
At least you wouldn't want to, for example, the first group's been out there for a month, and any sort of post-release effects have been shaken off. Mm-hmm. The other one's been out there for 2 days and started recapturing, and if it hasn't had that, you're going to have a problem.
Right, right. So wait long enough for the second set.
To have an opportunity to express it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
So then, I guess, so I missed part of what the whole concept was, but basically we'd end up with some estimate of, in this season, here's an estimate of reservoir survival for this size of fish. Well,
it'd be more like over a time period, like, you know, because they're growing and...
Which is actually probably the time period we need, because we know once they get past midsummer, they're larger and they're escaping a lot of the predation risk. The window that we're probably most concerned with.
Right. I mean, what's the management implication? In other words, releasing them in the reservoir or releasing below the reservoir? If you found, say you found survival is 10%.
Mm-hmm. Then you go to the head reservoir collection.
Well, I mean, that kind of goes to what Rich was saying. You got to have some benchmark to compare that to. And I don't know, what you do another reservoir where you expect to be very good survival?
Stephanie wants to do Fall Creek.
That is not my call.
No, but you could set it up and do the same study design in the second reservoir, right, in the same season, then look at the relative survival between those two groups.
If you think there's really a good reservoir versus a bad reservoir.
Yeah.
Yeah, the problem, well, the good one, well, Detroit.
Detroit, maybe.
Maybe, because Foster is not closed. You got a lot of fish moving right on through. Yeah. Detroit fish are in there from somewhere. Unless we spill.
So how are you going to base the decision on if you get 50% survival in one and 40% in the other? What do you do with that?
Well, like I said, I mean, the
study it another year.
If we have a replacement going on based on genetic pedigree, and then even if we measure 40% survival, if you're replacing yourself, you're getting upwards of, you know, you need to be above replacement, right? Mm-hmm. So. If then we're comparing that situation, 40% survival in Detroit, but yet we're still at near replacement.
I mean, what if you're getting 50% survival in Detroit, and you think they're replacing, you're getting 40%.
Good lookout?
Yeah. What do you do with that?
Well, if it's close, then that's a hard decision.
Tells you it's bad. You need. I mean, the other thing is your reservoir survival will change if you have a good passage facility, right? I mean,
if they can get out.
If they're able to get out, they're not stuck there for all those months having more opportunities to die. So, but if reservoir survival is only 10%, then I think we'd all work hard at head reservoir collection. Or drawdown, reservoir drawdown.
Well, I guess the easier way, Richie, would be is if it's at the same or better and lookout, then we know how to perceive the Zapdan passage is what you start to look at. If it's worse, then you got to start to factor in what else do we know about the system.
Yeah.
Dexter and Lookout are very low in the system. You have no wearing habitat immediately below Detroit. Yes, there is some, so eating replacement can get rearing opportunity. Number of things.
That's fair enough. I'm just wary of not having criteria for, you know, how you're going to deal with this. So I'm perfectly comfortable with a leaner, you know, it's not, we didn't exactly get the horseshoe, but it's close. You know, that's fine as long as everybody, you know, knows where they're at going into it.
Yeah, we don't do very well trying to establish criteria.
Right.
Yeah.
But I thought you originally said that if you had a survival over a certain number of weeks, for longer, and then you're saying, could you get them out by shortening that? Can you say that you increase the survival by shortening the time that they're exposed to whatever's causing them to not survive? So if you have to wait 8 weeks before they have passage versus 3 weeks or 2 weeks, that's the difference between having passage if once they make it to the dam or being collected and not spending 8 weeks at low survivals.
And I mean, part of it is, gets back to the whole concept of, do we want to promote reservoir rearing, or do we want to promote get the hell out of there? And so, you know, if reservoir mortality is bad, you either figure out how to get them out of there faster, don't let them get in the first place.
Or address the mortality issue. Mm-hmm.
Right, address the mortality.
Get the predators out of there.
That helps.
That's an interesting design, Fred, though we have not talked about before. I think John, I think it'd be worth John giving us a comparison in writing of that sort of a study design in comparison to a pit tag approach, where we're looking at having to redetect fish as they move through the reservoir and on downstream. Those that particular one would answer more questions potentially, reach survivals downstream. In terms of reservoir survival, a couple of different study designs would be good to compare.
Yeah. And we'll look at more than we've been able to. We'll look at a number of scenarios we'll have to do, sort of list out some of the good, bad, ugly alternatives.
Right. I mean, what Fred has mentioned here is cost effective for producing hatchery fish and having to do peripheral target analysis.
Looks like should we release the stagger in the treatment? Mushroom recovery 80%, 9% survival, standard error 1.5%.
He's done. That's service right there.
No, we did it 2 years ago. That's really not efficient.
Typical statistician. I put caveats all over.
So, Fred, what were you thinking? If you wanted to put this in place, when would it happen?
Well, there would have to be fish released in April, obviously, fry.
That would be
your question. You think you should
have wait, he's asking, is it FY16 or some other year?
Well, if it's FY16, then we have a confounding factor of potentially still being drawn down and having
You
need the production from the hatchery first. Yeah. So you need
well,
your
right,
hatchery
that,
fish.
You know, if the lookout point cave repairs continue to be pushed out or have issues and it continues into FY17, then we're not.
$100,000 fry is not a problem. It's a $100,000 issue, but we'd have to finesse this and see what we think with our amount of effort for recapturing. We wouldn't necessarily need $100,000.
It seems like a lot.
Yeah.
And you'll be gilding this summer. It seems like you'd have to wait till we had planned on typical operation again.
Oh, you're looking at a 2.5% recovery rate.
Not while we're doing an alternative operation. And
that's not huge.
Vanessa's, we might have better information on it now.
So, in terms of wrapping things up a little bit, we went through the survey. It didn't seem to me there were any real hot spot hybrid cities that people all cleaned up on and saying these are high priority. I didn't get anyone a lot of real excitement and say, yeah, that's exactly what we need to do.
I wouldn't mind just two minutes of conversation about delayed mortality. Why is delayed mortality following passage of operations not on that list as a high priority?
And this is a good question.
We've got some great data from John's group that there is an issue of delayed mortality getting down to one that falls in the North Sandy Dam active tag fish. that was a mystery at the time because there was conflicts between the results from that work and Thomas Perry release fish, but still, there seems to be a lot of uncertainty about it, and I don't know why it didn't rise to the top, or nearer the top than it did.
I would say because in some of these basins we're planning structures so that we wouldn't be, we'd no longer be as concerned with delayed mortality from operations.
We also talked about it as it's not a critical information you need to design the solution now. It may become a question after.
Yeah, especially right. Depending upon the method or the bypass that's associated with these structures. Delayed mortality could be a factor. So it wouldn't be operational per se as it is.
Okay.
But I'd say at facilities where we are talking operations, I would definitely be.
In the plan of operations, there are certain projects, development mitigations that are planned in the future. And are we, this was sort of independent of that, but there is a sort of ontogeny of construction and mitigation that's planned into the future. Have we listed the studies that need to be done to make those things operational and evaluated? In other words, pick one of the projects, like Cougar. What are you doing? What do you need to do to place it? What do you need to do to evaluate it? I mean, sort of in a very systematic kind of manner. I mean,
right. We've looked at Cougar, and you know the hydraulic information is not promising just because of the size of the reservoir. The wind can actually cause the surface currents to go upstream.
Mm-hmm.
So that caused everyone to look really hard at the tower alternative. So it's as at the tower as it can be, and it's in a confined space. So people feel pretty comfortable, at least. I'm looking at Rich.
Yeah,
because of, you know, there's just not a lot of other things.
Alternatives.
Yeah, it's pretty clear there. Mm-hmm. The choice aren't open, and I think that's why you have to do that on the hydraulic setting.
So everything needs to be done to start siting the facility has been done?
I'd have to let our engineers answer that, but there is no major
from a fish perspective. You know,
For Cougar, that's correct. We're using the PFFC, and where there is information that comes out of that, it will inform, but we don't have anything critical to stop us from designing.
Okay, the after's there.
It's
what are the things you want to do?
Right.
Post-effectiveness monitoring?
Yes.
Yeah, we haven't talked that here. We've been working with Stephanie. The Corps and NIMS have been discussing those things.
Yeah, obviously, those are part of the things that we sort of discussed. You know, whether you want to do, mm-hmm. you know, bloom tank says to look at acute effects. You want to do, you know, air releases to look at chronic effects. You want to do delayed mortality effects, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, and that discussion, that's something else we need to plan to have with water, but we haven't gotten there yet. We're still in the designing and getting something, things on the ground phase.
Is that something
we need to be planning for? It?
That I could or should be sort of, you know, if this is what you're going to do, these are three things that you place, you could do post-evaluation.
No, I don't think it'd be efficient for you to work that, John, because we don't know exactly what will hit the ground at each site.
Okay.
So that'd be hard to design for without having to make assumptions about a range of alternatives.
Okay.
I think it's more about, you know, from my perspective, like to hear others helping us think about the study designs to address critical needs that we've talked around today and coming up in the table.
So Detroit raises the top of hydraulic study. It's 83%. Probably the highest one out there besides that one that we've talked about.
I'm just looking through. The highest study was 86%.
Yeah.
And that was Lookout Point, fish movement.
And then the next place is Detroit.
Right.
But anyway, when we do plant it, and there's a couple edits to this table. There's a line missing. Might want to check the numbers a little bit. But we will send this out.
Yeah, we'll happy to share it. It was just a thumbnail.
Can you share John's presentation too?
I have no problem sending. You've got the PowerPoint, and you can send it forth if you wish.
I will.
And there are a couple of publications. There's one on slope marking studies, one on the TripFit program. There's also one on the, what's the third one? TripFit. Those are the two main ones.
Will you send those sites so we can make sure that
we're not?
Yeah, there's one on prime marking.
So I'm going to put Stephanie on the spot. That's good.
And what metrics we're going to want to look at, because we're going, I mean,
would it be useful if,
but if we're not, we're probably going to want to.
Would it be useful if NIFs talked to the science, to our science center, and thought about ways we could use recovery plans or something else to generate some range of, you know, the number of fry or smolts that you're likely to see come out of some of these systems, if you're making the leap that you could get to those recovery levels? It's just a way of scaling.
We've been working with the Science Center.
Already?
They produced life cycle models for each of the populations, the project effects, scaling, Chinook. They're currently on contract to look at capacity above the projects and in the reservoirs.
Okay, so you think that work will generate those numbers?
Well, it will provide that capacity.
It won't.
I mean, that's just the overall. They will then probably run it through the life cycle model to help look at production potential by reach.
So they've already done a dumping hole for egg fry, but now we're looking at capacity for beyond fry to see if there's other.
Well, I'm just trying to think of a way to help your four-bay abundance.
Well, the model, I mean, the SLAM model, you know, we can go back and look at that in terms of, you know, it said if you accept all the different hits on survival as the fish enter the reservoir and which ones, you know, survive to get to different life stages, you can come up with how many fish actually are in the four-bay ready to be captured. The way it comes out, it's hard to get those actual total numbers, but that could be done.
Yep.
I mean, if that helps the designers size the facility.
It seems like pulling those numbers together just to look at it would be a useful exercise.
I just remember when we were doing that part of the SLAM model, it seemed like we were killing a bunch of the fish, so that by the time we got to the four-bay, we'd already killed tons of them.
That's partly they're working to look at the reservoir capacities and other reach.
You can take fairly significant hits from fry to small stage as long as you don't have a lot of other insults. Hanford Reach Paul Schnucker are a great example of that.
Actually, NOAA has that contract where they do a lot of experimental detection development. Like, so I think they're considering doing like the Bonneville Powerhouse 1 sluiceway detection. Like, it seems to be feasible. And in the John Bay, they've been looking at, that's where they have the experimental, like, tributary pit detection. But it's hard to, like, take a river the size of the John Day and kind of visualize the different tributary and reaches we're working with. But do you think that they're at a state where we could take something that they've just recently developed and kind of, because with a lot of this, it just seems like it would be convenient to have more sites with pit detection. I don't know if you could.
Well, they've been really focused, I would say, on smaller tributaries. Better flat plate detectors, stuff like that. Whereas what you need to crack this nut is big river, you know, Willamette kind of something, which is not going to avail itself to a flat plate.
or actually trying to get pit peg detections in a reservoir. That's why I was thinking that, you know, Ledger was retired, but his crew is still down there, and they were playing around with, you know, basically getting rid of the trawls, and could you just tow a pit tag detector without wing walls? Because you're giving up surface area that you're collecting, but you're gaining velocity. So you can theoretically at least get the same amount of water through the detector, and maybe it's a lot safer. So, I just thought it would be worth, you know, asking those guys, you know, just as a proof of concept, maybe you can throw one of these things behind a boat, drag it around, and get a bunch of pit tag detections. Might be worth a shot. I don't, can't guarantee it'll work, but if not, it's
so we asked John to kind of be planning to write up the results of this.
Did she agree?
He's gonna explain every one of the boxes up there. No, but the intent was to hone in on a few study designs for key issues that were brought up today. And so John will review the notes that come from this, review this table, and then maybe we will talk about
the reservoir. I think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Probably the one of the multiple different release strategies in the reservoir over time and space and see which ones have the best downstream recovery. That's a very easy one, straightforward one, probably. One that's going on, we can do those quite straightforward.
Okay.
So what about improving efficiency detections? Will that fall?
Yeah, we'll have to discuss. I think discussing that again, increasing the detection rate at Willamette Falls doesn't account for the fact that fish are coming through at different times when the rates are different.
Right, so can we evaluate that, trying to help with the right
mm-hmm.
way, improve
you? I think it's more will than weather.
Okay. Will we?
They will
no, if we have the will to do it. Because it's going to take some field effort and consistency and persistence to be able to get those efficiencies. More whether you have the will to do it rather than whether it can be done.
Well, okay, but that's what I mean. I think that part of why we didn't do it last year was because there was a lot of question about whether it could be a scientifically valid thing to do. And it sounds like you're saying it could be. I was hoping if you could write that up somehow, that might help us move forward.
And part of that, too, is we could look at the size of those efficiency releases, because obviously that adds noise to the estimate because you're calibrated by an estimate of efficiency. So the better the estimate of efficiency, the less error in that adjustment. So we can do issues in terms of, you know, what's the release, initial release size, but what are the efficiency releases that you need to be able to do, you know, can you get away with 100 fish per week, or does that have to be 1,000 fish? Now, because that could really change your attitude on something.
Yeah, definitely. Your will attitude.
When you're asking about that, and I agree with you, that'd be good to hear from you. But what are the questions you're thinking of addressing with that improvement in pit tag?
I think we're talking about delayed mortality, or we're talking about the whole question about head of reservoir versus, you know, within reservoir. That it seems like that it's another way to get at that question.
And there's added value in actually being able to expand to get a total abundance estimate of fish leaving the entire watershed. Mm-hmm. If you get good detection capabilities and lots of pit tags in both wild and hatchery fish, and the ability to expand pit tag detections to a total of migrants is incredibly valuable.
Yeah,
it's
for years. But it doesn't lead us to design.
No, it's added value.
Yeah.
Got it.
Well, with 4 or 5 minutes to four, we officially adjourn. Well, thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate everybody's time.
Let's not forget to thank Carrie, our note taker. She's been typing all day long.
We can't wait.
Great, we expect to see those tomorrow.
Don't hold your breath.
Yeah,
don't thank me yet.
That is actually true. mapping.
All work and no play.
Yeah. Ordering stuff off of Amazon.
Yeah,
I've
been shopping.
Yeah.
Getting ahead on my Christmas shopping.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm on a mail, but I'd be interested.